Hello, welcome to a special episode of Talking Beasts of the Narnia podcast. What you're about to hear is the audio from a live commentary for Prince Caspian that we live streamed on YouTube for the 10th anniversary watch party. To properly follow along at home, sync up the time code of this episode with the time code of your Prince Caspian DVD, Blu-ray, or digital file. Or, if you'd like to watch the video of the event, check the episode description for the link. This is Glum Puddle.
And I'm Jim Fan.
And to everyone in the YouTube comments section, thanks so much for joining us for the Prince Caspian 10th Anniversary Watch Party. And to anyone who is listening to this in the future as a podcast episode, let me just explain that we may occasionally respond to YouTube comments that you cannot see. Just be aware of that. Hey, it's your fault for missing the watch party. What can I say? We're streaming this on May 12th, 2018 right now. Also, for anyone watching live on YouTube, feel free to post Narnia trivia questions and see if you can stump us. Could be related to books, movies, C.S. Lewis, gymnastics, you know, whatever. But anyway, here we are recording a commentary for the first time in about 9.5 years. We recorded another one just after this came out on DVD.
It's been shorter than that. We did it more recently.
Did we do an actual commentary?
We did, because I was in Taiwan and we recorded it. Or was that the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
That was for Lion, the Witch,
and
the Wardrobe.
You're right. Oh, I remember this intro.
Jim Fan and I may not necessarily talk a whole lot. I really want to just read the comments and have people in the YouTube comments section kind of drive this. So
yeah,
if we just get caught up in the movie and go silent on occasion, or we're reading comments or whatever, that is fine with me. But we're watching General Clausel, and Mira is looking at Tarva and Elendil right now.
You know your orders.
Leah says, this is just like the opening of Man of Steel, but with less Hans Zimmer. And I'm
Because of the childbirth thing, I guess?
Yeah. I'm like blanking. I'm like, what was the opening of that again? I was like, oh yeah, now I remember.
Yeah, same. I should be playing. Just get your movie caught up to the time code. Yeah, I don't think... Did we know how this was going to open before? I think we did. I think we knew it was going to open with Tarva and Elendil, that kind of Raiders of the Lost Ark thing of fading from the movie's logo to something in the movie.
You have your orders, General Glumpuddle. I like that.
And then everyone's like, it's Caspian!
5 more minutes.
And he's about to go into the wardrobe here.
Not that kind of wardrobe.
Or maybe it is. Maybe it's the same wardrobe. You know, just like the White Witch and the Lady... No, I won't go there. Never mind. Never mind. I won't go there.
I did love how they decided to open the movie this way instead of doing it the way in the books. I feel like cinematically it works and it just kind of gets you... into the story right away.
It's hard that they cut out... sorry, Dot. It's hard that they had to cut out... I mean, I think this is a pretty effective opening for the movie, especially if you just finished Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and you think this is going to be the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe sequel. You're like, wait, where am I? But at the same time, it's heartbreaking that they cut out basically all of Caspian's early childhood and the iconic scene of Cornelius and Caspian on the tower talking about old Narnia. I mean, that is the scene... in the Prince Caspian book. And I understand why it's not in here, but I don't at the same time. I think it's the best scene in the book. It's the best scene in the book.
I think that's where a lot of the... Like, for me, I wasn't as attached to Prince Caspian, the book, as I was to other books. So for me, I was just more interested to see, like, how is this going to translate into screen? And I've said this before. I will go on record. I'll say it again. I love Prince Caspian, the movie. I think I love almost everything about it. So, I don't have a whole lot of complaints about how they kind of stitched it together from the book, just because I think it works well.
Whereas I have still mixed feelings. I think it's an okay, I think it works pretty well as a movie overall. Even though there's a lot of changes I just hate. And, well, I was listening to some of the movie Aristotle, you are right. They have a little bit of Caspian and Cornelius in the video game, but which is a nice scene, but it doesn't capture, when you read the book, the magic of looking at the stars and Tarva and Elendil, and it means some great good for the sad realm of Narnia. We just don't get that magic and wonder, I think, even in the video game scene.
Mm.
But I continue to have really mixed feelings about this. What it comes down to is basically the things that I like, I really, really like a lot. And the things I hate, I really, really
hate. You really, really hate a lot.
It just feels a lot more confidently directed than The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So in that sense, I think it's a slightly better movie.
Mm.
And I don't know. Looking at this again, I'll see how I feel after having 10 years to kind of stew on it.
Yeah, I just remember I've just always loved Prince Caspian, the movie. And obviously, you know, there's things in it that I didn't like as much, and I wish they'd done a little bit differently. But just overall, if I had been going into this not being as familiar with the books as I was, I probably would have looked at it and been like, wow, that's a well-made movie.
Yeah, Moonlight Centaur is saying, I think Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is the best film, but Prince Caspian is the best book. Hmm. Interesting. I think usually when we do polls, Prince Caspian is right at the bottom as far as users' favorite book. And that could be one reason why I'm more forgiving of the changes and kind of more willing to look at this as... It's easier for me to look at this in isolation. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe had so much in it that was iconic.
Yeah.
That you can't change that. I mean, every little every single word of the Lucy Tumnus meeting that wasn't exactly from the book was like startling for me. No, that's not how it goes.
Yeah.
That's such an iconic scene. With Prince Caspian, there's not as much in it that is so ingrained. Oh, that has to be the way it is. So I'm a little more forgiving of that. And that probably, it's probably another reason why I can't stand the Dawn Treader movie.
I know, because we all love the Dawn Treader, and what was done to that book was a crime, so I'm with you there.
I still feel like you go back and forth on this one.
Over time.
This is it. Out of five, give me your rating for The Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
Like, overall, like, there are some parts in Dawn Treader that I love, but those are very, very, very small scenes. The rest of it, just like the overall effect overall, especially as I've gone back and watched it over again, I'm like, green mist is all I'm going to say.
Gotcha. I don't think my opinion of Dawn Treader has changed much at all. I thought it's like a 1.5 out of 5 for me, and it's stayed about there. Prince Caspian, the first time I saw it, I really liked it. I thought it was a big thumbs up, and I've watched it more, and I definitely don't like it as much as I did the first time. But I still think it's a pretty good movie, and it's an okay adaptation. There's aspects of the book that did a good job of capturing, even though there were some that they definitely didn't. But I kind of go back and forth.
Yeah.
Oh, Matthew wants to know what. I know we should, I guess, hey, whatever. It's we can just have fun.
Talk about what you want.
We can just put in the Dawn Treader DVD right now and watch
right?
that.
that would be an we'll have to do that sometime just for laughs.
We have to make sure we do it like this remotely where we're in different cities so I don't strangle you as we're. Anyway, so put you on the spot really quick. Do you want to, what scenes come to mind that you liked in Dawn Treader?
The ending, the beginning and the end. And look, we're back in London.
I was happy when it was over. I agree with you on that one.
The first 20 minutes of Dawn Treader, I really, really, really love. And I love Eustace. Will Poulter was amazing. And then the ending was really beautiful. But the middle...
I liked the last couple minutes. Anyway, so we're in London now. Yeah, the transition... Reepicheep 775 pointing out the transition
that was
there.
Yeah, that was a good transition. And... I thought it was good kind of getting you back to where the kids are and seeing how life has changed for them and not all in good ways.
Mm-hmm. I guess I understand as a screenwriter thinking, well, what was it like to be a king for, you know, something like 20 years and then going back to being a normal kid again. I can understand wanting to explore that, but I just prefer the idea you get in the book, which is that they basically instantly just went back to being kids, and it's sort of the way I read it as, but somewhere in there, they're still the kings and queens. Mm. You know, I feel like I'm talking about the Incredible Hulk right now, but it's somewhere in there, they're the kings and queens. It's deep down, but it's still who they are. And then the feeling of coming back, and it's like coming home.
Yeah.
Yeah, Becca is complaining about Peter's character, which, as a lot of people will, and I completely understand and largely agree with. But I wish they had done Peter more in a way that was more sympathetic, I guess. I understand.
Yeah, I see where they were going with their interpretation of the kids coming back into our world and, like, this difficulties they would have faced. That's just one interpretation, and I think... it's a bit different than what is implied in the books, but it doesn't mean it's incorrect. It's just one person's interpretation of how it might have been.
I would agree with that insofar as, I don't know, the book really doesn't get into it at all.
Yeah.
I've just kind of inferred a lot of, yeah, I guess that would be tricky to go back to, being a normal kid. And I'm sure they were, when are we going to go back to Narnia? You know, to me, I just infer, yeah, that must have been an element of it. Here, you think that it's had this really damaging effect on Peter's life. And you just want him to grow up. And he just seems so full of it. And I don't see the High King Peter even buried deep down in there at all, I guess. I just see a bratty kid.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me to relate to. I've never been like a king before and had to go through that. So
it's a new experience for all of us.
Right. I can understand the experience of being trapped somewhere. And that feeling is in the book. That feeling of the holidays are almost over. Isn't that terrible? That sucks. Oh, we're back in Narnia where we belong. You know, that's great.
This transition is brilliant, I think.
Amy asking about the transition. Yeah.
Just about everything about this scene.
It's neat, but I still think I would have preferred something. This is really cool and creative. I think I would have preferred something a little simpler, though. And something that felt more... Right now, it's the world around them getting torn apart. I would have liked to feel like... I know there's a couple lines of dialogue where Lucy and them say things like... they're pulling on me from the book. But I would have liked something that felt more violent, like something was pulling on them. Like they're almost being torn apart. And I would have preferred something a little simpler.
Yeah.
This is cool, but I think it would have been more interesting to go sort of the subtle route and the more violent route. My sister has been there before. Cathedral Cove.
Oh, I've never been to New Zealand, but I would love to go. Planning on going at some point. And, of course, would have to go find this place because it's beautiful.
And I think you nailed it there. And sing the line from the book where Peter says, I'm not here to take your throne, but put you into it. Which Peter does ultimately get to in this movie. It just takes some time. It's a longer journey for him.
Yeah.
Conceptually, the idea of Peter having a hard time, like, you know, coming back to Narnia and saying, yes, I'm the High King and I'm going to do this, and then realizing, no, Aslan's got to do it, and actually I have to give up the kingship to someone else. I think that's a perfectly valid idea that's in the book and has a lot of potential on film. I think so conceptually I like the idea. I think it was just the direction they went in William Moseley's performance that sank it. I just don't think it works.
Yeah.
I just don't think you get inside his head. You don't relate to him at all. He just comes across as a bratty child.
Yeah. Definitely. Oh, man. Every time I see this scene, I'm like, I just want to go swimming there.
Whereas I grew up in Florida, so I'm like, they're going to have salt in their clothes.
Right, and all that sand.
They're going to be walking. That's gross. They're going to be walking around. Look at that. They're knee deep in the water. They're going to be walking around. They're going to be miserable. And then when we were watching Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I was like, I'd play in the snow, totally. And you guys were like, no, you'd get all wet and cold. It wouldn't be fun at all.
This is true.
I wish the ruins looked a little more... Well,
it's extremely
more
ruined.
Ruinous, I guess. I don't know. I don't know. Or maybe they just look a little too... Ooh, there's the only glimpse we get of the apples.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point, AJ. Although the snowball fight... That wasn't in the extended version, was it? Yeah, the snowball fight in Lion, the Witch... AJ Aiken saying that it's kind of them playing in the water is kind of a nice callback to...
Yeah.
They have a little snowball fight in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Oh, I see Becca. Becca's saying, don't worry, it's magic. The clothes will just instantly dry.
Yeah.
We already know that Narnians bleed clear, so maybe their clothes instantly
dry as
well.
Movie magic.
I think it was a good decision to not spend as much time. Like, they figure out it's Cara Paravel pretty quickly compared to the book. It takes a long time in the book for them to figure it out, which, frankly, I felt was, I was reading the book going, okay, come on, guys, come on, come on. Like, I knew it was Cara Paravel immediately. It was, had to wait like a chapter and a half for the kids to catch up.
Yeah.
So that's something in the book I don't love. And certainly in terms of filmic pacing, I think it was fine.
Yeah.
How they kind of sped it up here.
Because you kind of need to get the story going. You know, you've got 2+ hours. You just need to kind of get on with it and not spend too much time on something that's, unless it's, you know, for character development, and for that, it just wasn't really, it was just there.
Ooh, Reaper Cheap 775 wants a Narnia chess set. Yes,
would
please.
Love that. Someone make one and I
someone
will buy it.
Someone make that. Oh, I always look at the Harry Potter merchandise and I get so jealous just of the number of things they have. Like, if you're a Harry Potter fan, there's nothing else better. Like, yeah. No, there's no fandom that has better merchandise than Harry Potter. And how cool would it have been if Narnia had taken off and we had things like the Narnia chess set and I still want my Puddle Glum action figure. Maybe I'll get it. Maybe I'll get it.
Fingers crossed.
We do have Reaper Cheap. This is the best piece of Narnia merchandise ever created.
I have that as well somewhere.
I'm sure Reaper Cheap himself would be utterly horrified at this. I've actually got 2 of these. I have one for safety in case something were to happen to this. But
your little Reaper Cheap plushie.
Reaper Cheap, if you're watching right now, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry that this happened. But I like it. Okay, we've got Miraz. Too bad, Becca. It's mine. You can't have it. You can't have it.
I'm sure you can find it on eBay. I love the set design. I thought they did a great job with it, for giving the Telmarines like a backstory and a culture.
Dodd is saying they should have kept the extended scene where Puna Prismia asks where Caspian is. That is a bit of a... There's a couple deleted scenes with Puna Prismia, I think. As it stands in the movie, you don't. It's hard to know exactly what she's thinking about. How does she feel about what Miraz is doing, and how much does she actually know about it is kind of a mystery. Which, I mean, she's barely... That's obviously more than we even get in the book, so whatever.
Yeah.
Moonlight Centaur, Reaper Cheap is... I mean, on the 8th day, yeah. C.S. Lewis made Reaper Cheap. He's so awesome. Yeah, so Reaper Cheap 775 pointing out that there's empty seats in this throne room with Miraz. So what's interesting is I think we all assumed that, we all assumed when we saw this that they were setting up Dawn Treader and saying that, oh, those are the missing lords. Are there actually 7 empty seats? I don't remember. Are there 7 empty seats?
I think we counted
seats?
And there was.
We counted. I remember it was a little tricky to determine, as I recall. Are there actually 7 empty seats in this throne room? Somebody wants to rewind and go look at that.
I feel like we counted and there was, or it was meant like that. Even if there wasn't exactly 7, that was meant to be the fans kind of Easter egg to be like, oh yeah, remember that thing that calls to this thing coming in the future? There it is.
Right.
If you're not looking for it, you're not going to care. But if you are looking for it, it's like, oh yeah.
Right. Wow, this is going so fast. Whew.
I know. Trumpkin.
But it doesn't have to be. It's in the Dawn Treader movie. I don't think they ever called back to it. They just basically said, oh yeah, his
oh
friends,
yeah, no, they did.
His friends fled and they left. And
it
that's
was
it.
Also different people making Dawn Treader movie. I have always wondered what might have happened. I don't know. That's another conversation for another day.
Mm-hmm.
If the creative crew had been consistent between Prince Caspian and Dawn Treader, more consistent, like same direction and stuff, what might have carried over a bit more? I don't know.
And you wonder why we don't like you.
It's like...
Remember, one thing that bothered me is in the... I think it's what Miraz believes and what he knows about old Narnia isn't really clear. Does he think that they were just fairy tales and seeing Trumpkin is shocking because, oh, I thought these were just fairy tales? Or is it, I thought they were dead? I thought they were extinct.
I feel and like the latter
kind of goes back and forth.
Is kind of what I've always figured for him in the movie, anyway.
What's that?
For him in the movie, I feel like it's the latter. He just feels like it's extinct. It's right. just not around anymore.
There's a few times in the movie, though, where he kind of, I mean, you could kind of read it either way. There's a few times in the movie where he kind of suggests both, and you're not exactly sure, which I wish they were more consistent on that, because that's a really important point that Miraz has been telling Caspian and everybody. You know, this is all fairy tales and never happened, and actually it's real. And Caspian's joy at discovering that it's all real, it's all true, is something we don't get nearly enough of the movie. Yeah. And there's a couple missed opportunities I'll point out where they could easily have had a moment here with Caspian and they just overlook it.
Getting into the vault.
This is cool. I think this joke... I wish it's funny, I guess. I think they could have directed it a little bit better, but the whole he's being all commando, Mr. Survival skills.
We're going to make this work. And Edmund's like, oh, let's just use this instead.
And that because the torch is such a small but awesome thing in the book, but such a memorable thing in the book. And so it's fun to, I mean, we all cheer a little bit when we see that.
And then it just becomes this running thing in the movie, which I, and in the next one, which I love. That was a great
running joke.
They make the torch gets its own character development.
This is an okay scene. I wish. I mean, it doesn't capture the magic of we're in the treasure chamber now. I don't think it captures the wonder of the book of. They're sort of stunned into silence. And there's this, I love the line in the book where it's, they all felt that it really was Peter the High King again. And, oh, I really love when it says they're looking at their old treasures and saying, it felt like meeting very old friends. Mm. I don't think we don't quite get that somberness here as much. And I wish they had done, you know, when they flash the torch around and they go, ooh, and they see the treasure and there's that moment. I don't quite get the solemnness and the nostalgia here as much. But it's a pretty good. I think this is a pretty good scene, though.
Yeah, and just being able to find their old treasures, and they're like, oh yeah,
you got Aslan, a point dot about the feet. I always think about that when they're running across the floor, like ooh, the bottom of their feet. That's like stepping on Legos.
Dirty. I was reading up in the chat a little bit earlier, and Leah said that I find the decision to have Mediterranean Telmarine, I think it's supposed to be a like, the decision to have Mediterranean Telmarines, because if you consider from a real historical perspective how the Spanish colonized and treated indigenous people, it's pretty interesting. And I think that is a very interesting point and kind of what I've thought as well, just kind of drawing little parallels between Narnia and real world, making it easier for people to kind of relate to it a bit.
It makes sense conceptually. I wish they'd gone, like that helmet especially, that feels very much like something out of our world. I've seen that before. I wish they'd gone a few steps further. I like that idea of being like an influence. Mm. But I wish they'd gone a few steps further away from reality. It's a good point, movie Aristotle. It does kind of feel like they don't have that much treasure.
Yeah, it's just a little bit. And I always thought it was weird, like, they've got those treasure chests down there, but they've got, like, clothes in them. Like, why would you put, like, dresses in a chest?
You know, just in case.
Just
you know,
in case.
This is, I'm sure, a few days before they went hunting for the white stag. It's like, you know, I should put... Lucy's like, you know, I should put my dress in here from when I was 8 years old, you know, just in case.
Yeah,
1,300
never
years I come
know.
Back. They just ran into, it's like Superman. They ran into a phone booth and came out and
Right? Here
they are. They even have the heroic music to accompany them. Susan doesn't actually hit anybody in the book, does she? No, she doesn't because she says, yeah. I wasn't, she says something like, I wasn't shooting to kill, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, she does say that. I don't even have to look that up. She does. Oh, poor Twumpkin.
And they're like, we saved you. And he's like.
And the book, of course, when Trumpkin comes, I mean, the story has been at a kind of a standstill for a while. Then Trumpkin comes and adds this mystery to the story. Mm. Wow, where did he come from? And it's going to take four chapters to explain. Here, we already know more or less. I know that where he came from. There aren't that many unanswered questions. And so I don't think it's quite as exciting of a moment.
Yeah. But it's still...
And Peter Dinklage, I mean, Trumpkin's a pretty different character in this movie than he is in the book.
Yeah.
He's a lot more dour. Is that the word, I guess?
Yeah, that could be a word.
Maybe if you had switched, a few people have suggested this. Really, Warwick Davis probably should have played Trumpkin, and Peter Dinklage should have played Knickerbrick. Maybe we would have gotten more accurate characters if we'd done that.
Got to be kidding me.
That's a good point, Leah. The Telmarine that Susan shot, what became of them? I guess they both just swam away. I mean, that happens in the book, I guess. By the way, publication order, if that will autofocus. I guess it won't. Let's see, on the inside somewhere. Oh, it says on the front. Book two. That's right, that's right. If there was any doubt. I talked to a couple people that read the book where this sword fight between Edmund and Trumpkin confuses them. They don't quite understand the point of it and what it achieved. Obviously, from reading the book, we know that they're trying to prove themselves.
Oh, you're saying people who watch the movie.
Who have not read the book.
Ah, gotcha, gotcha.
They read it and go, they're like, wait, what was the point of that? And why did Edmund do it? And it is cool they included the bit that Lewis describes where it's, oh, the cool thing is to like jump over it or something like that. He says something in the book like, it's cool to jump over the sword. Like, he talks about this technique or whatever. I forget. It's been a...
it's been a while.
It's been a while.
And now we're back to Caspian, who's been absent for a while now in the movie. Mm-hmm. It's fine, because it's his movie. It's titled after him. So,
It's really Peter's movie and maybe Lucy's. Caspian is... kind of absent for a lot of it. Anyone got any stump questions? Feel free to do your worst. Throw them out at us. You'll just have to take our word for it that we're not looking them up online.
You never know.
Mm-hmm. There's a... Who does Ken Stott play in The Hobbit? I forget. Balin. So that's Balin playing Truffle Hunter. Nerd crossover moment. Or maybe they're all, maybe there's a cinematic universe
right.
Where Balin turns into a badger. let the fan fiction begin.
That would be a very strange fan fiction. I did
what
think
are
it,
you?
It is funny. It's like, he's just a boy. And then they look at Caspian and is like, he's a boy, okay. I don't see that.
So how do we feel about his accent, people?
Eh.
We've had 10 years to get used to it. Eh. How do we feel about the Telmarine accent?
That was not a good decision. What?
Yeah. Oops, stump question. Dot wants to know, which gods did Erebus say she was going to spend days giving sacrifices to so she would have a head start when she ran away? And the horseman's boy, of course.
That one's yours. I couldn't even begin to guess.
I feel like I know that. Is it? I think it ends with a DA sound. I think I'm going to declare myself stumped. Both of us stumped on this one. Dot, if you want to give the answer.
Or is there anyone else in the comment who knows?
Who wants to take a shot at it? Oh, man.
Wah, wah, wah.
I thought it ended with a DA. All right, waiting for the answer on that one.
Oh, that's a good... Ah!
I think that's Zardina, they're saying in the comments section. I have to wait for someone wants to confirm that. But back to the accent. Amanda saying it hampered Ben's acting. I think it probably would not have if he had more time to prepare. But they had, I think they had actually started rolling cameras by the time Ben was.
He was a very late addition, wasn't he?
New Zealand and like Ben came to New Zealand and like less than a week later he was filming.
Mm.
So he had very little time to prepare.
Overall, I think I prefer his performance in Don Treader. And performance, I mean like the accent, the look, the package, I think works in Don Treader a lot better than it does in Caspian.
I agree, definitely. We'll agree on that one, on Don Treader.
Yeah.
Man, if we do a Don Treader commentary, we are just going to be... I at least will be just throwing stuff at the screen, which could be make for some entertaining TV, I guess. But
that would be one to tune in, folks.
Oh, I love this scene. What? Static. Cornelius doesn't get a lot to do in the movie, does he?
He doesn't.
I've heard a lot of people who have not read the book who watch this and go like, I don't get why that Santa Claus guy is in the movie so much. He's only in like two scenes, but I just felt like they had to get him in there because he is such an important character.
Yeah. But he's used for a lot of exposition.
Yeah.
In a way.
Mm-hmm. And of course, they haven't had the time to develop. They developed their relationship so well. Lewis develops the relationship between Caspian and Cornelius so well in the book. And here we infer that they had a relationship, but we really don't ever get to see it. They have such a special bond in the book.
Yeah.
And the fact they don't have that here at all is just one of the... I understand why. Because it's all about just changing the restructuring. Or restructuring the movie so that it doesn't have to have a 4-chapter flashback. And that caused just about every other big change. Once you decide we want to tell a linear chronological story and not flashback, that causes domino effect, caused everything else. And that included, it means if we want to start with the blowing of the horn, have that be the opening of our movie to get the Pevensey storyline started, then we can't do a flashback, of course. We got to get them right in the way.
Yeah,
we got to get them off at the very beginning, which means you have to blow the horn in the opening scene, which means, well, obviously Caspian is not going to blow the horn until he's in danger.
Yeah, it just changed a lot of the pacing or the structure of the film, which I don't have a problem with. I think how they ended up making it work, it works. Like, you lose some things, but then you gain things in terms of cinematic pacing. I think the pacing of the book, like the way it had worked, I don't think that would have translated well to a movie, starting it the way the book starts and then going on. Just because then you wouldn't even see the Pevenseys for like a long time. And that's just, it's not a good movie.
I'm undecided. I think it could have worked possibly. I mean, if they had just followed the book. I like the idea of starting briefly with Caspian. Like my version of Prince Caspian, the opening scene, we should talk about what we're looking at, I see. But the opening scene is Caspian and Cornelius on the tower. It's the opening scene. And they talk about, oh, yes, the kings and queens of old. Oh, so we say, oh, it's 1,300 years later, and the kings and queens are legends or whatever. And as they're talking about them, we transition to the Pevensey standing on the platform and getting yanked off the platform. So now we know, oh, at some point we're going to get back to – we're going to explain what we're seeing there in the opening scene. So when we flash back, it's not quite so jarring. I think if you did that, that would help a lot.
Yeah.
Because I've seen it work, like in Fight Club, where you start at basically the end of the story and then flash back and explain how you got there. I think it could work really well.
But it's just a different... It's a different directing choice. It's a different screenwriting choice. And I don't know, maybe, you know, give us...
I understand.
You know, good like 20 years or so, and maybe we'll see them make Prince Caspian again, and they'll do it in a totally different way, and it'll be cool. Like, I like seeing different people's
reboots.
Interpretations of things.
Reboots. Fans have gotten really greedy in the reboot department.
Yeah.
They go see something, and one thing is wrong. Oh, reboot it. Start over.
Spider-Man. It's like been, what, like 3 or 4 times?
Yep. So Coracle was saying that Cornelius is too tall. He is certainly a little taller than I would imagine, but It's funny. I think of him as being kind of short. My memory, when I look at, when I think about the movie, I do think of him as being rather short. I think they tend to frame the kind of do the Back to the Future thing, where they kind of frame the shot so that he looks a lot smaller than he is.
This scene in the movie, I always was like, Lucy, why did you automatically assume? Because they had both kinds in Narnia before, so. I don't know.
Did we in the movies though? Did we see both kinds? Are there in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
In the movies,
did we ever
you didn't.
See?
So I suppose from a movie's perspective. Well, actually, I don't know. Someone correct me if I'm wrong.
I don't think we see. I mean, it's hard to say because you see in the battle we see normal animals. We see normal. We see talking animals at the battle, but we don't really. I mean, we have like to infer they're talking because we don't actually see them talking. They're just growling and fighting.
Yeah. Like the polar bears that were pulling the White Witch's sleigh. Like, I never assumed those were talking polar bears.
Good point. And the unicorn that Peter rides, probably not.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, the unicorn, I mean, because unicorns are kind of like special. So, like, in my mind, they were talking.
But either way, we certainly see a lot more.
Yeah, I don't know.
Top animals that we would infer to be talking animals in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe than otherwise. Now, I can understand, though, in the context of the scene, I mean, yeah, if you think it through, any viewer should be able to infer that, I think. But I can understand in the context of the scene, just in the flow of the movie going, wait a minute, why would she just assume like that?
Yeah. I guess if you think about it from the cinematic universe, it makes sense, but it's not really ever talked about very much. So it's not really established that.
Yeah. Moonlight Centaur asking about the bulgy bear makes me think, what if they had made it so that you saw the bulgy bear earlier in the movie.
I don't know.
I'm not sure how they would do that. So that, like, we've seen a talking bear. So, talking bear. Okay, that's our reference for bears in this world. So we're a little surprised, too. Because they don't set up the world enough. If they had established, we've seen a bear earlier in the movie that was not a talking bear, then we might be just as surprised as Lucy was when, there's another bear who's not a talking bear. The problem is, as an audience, we immediately assume it's just a normal dumb bear. That's our first inclination.
Right.
So we can't break the bear. But I like what they do with it. I like the idea of Lucy naively assuming it's not, that it is a talking bear. I think it just sheds light on how the Narnia of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is. That's not this anymore. And things will happen in this world that we didn't think were allowed to happen in Narnia.
Yeah.
And I do like the moment where Trumpkin pulls out the knife and Lucy turns away. I wish he hadn't said, I think you might find Narnia a more savage place than you remember. I think that comes through well enough without him having to actually say it.
You don't really need to. Yeah, it's a bit unnecessary.
There's a couple moments like that in the new Blade Runner movie where it comes across really well and they've... Great filmmaking. They really conveyed something visually, but they didn't quite have the confidence they had done it. So they have to put in some dialogue and exposition, which is like, no, you got it right. You got it right. It's fine. And here comes
the introduction. Here is our famous, infamous, depending on how you talk about it.
Yeah, well, let's go to the comments section. Is this scene famous or infamous? What did you like of Reaper Chief? What did you think of Reaper Chief's introduction? It's a little cheesy in Hollywood, I understand. Like, my brain wants to... Yes, the arrow doesn't spin. You're right, Marcus. there might be one or two things in this movie that aren't completely realistic. Just throwing that out there.
Shocker!
I'm kidding. I'm with you. But there's intellectually, I kind of want to look at the scene and be like, oh, brother, that's such a big dramatic introduction for Reaper Cheap. And yet, my heart stands up and cheers every time. So what can I say?
Because it's Reaper Cheap, and... What else do you expect?
I've got the Jaws music in my head for this part, especially when he's coming towards Caspian. Dun 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 dun.
I remember having mixed feelings about this, just because like Reaper Cheap's not supposed to be comedic, and in the movie he kind of is very obviously comedic.
Dun 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 dun. No, yeah, this was something we were me and Rillian really liked Reaper Cheap, and you were like, nah, I didn't really like him so much.
Yeah.
In the comments section, let us know like what did you think about Reaper Cheap overall, and Jim Fan, tell me why you didn't like him.
Well, it wasn't that I didn't like him. It's just it wasn't what I had in my mind. He was never really funny to me in the book. He was just, like, the humor to him is the what's the word? Not the paradox, but like, because he's a mouse,
he's a mouse, but he's so, he has such a big personality.
Yeah.
He's so brave.
And that's just more like ironically funny. It's not like, ha ha, that's hilarious.
It's a fair point.
I liked him in Dawn Treader more.
Because they don't do anything with him in Dawn Treader. That's why. He has one scene where he's like, oh yeah, I want to be at the world's end. And after that, you kind of forget about him. He has a couple one-liners.
Well, like the him and Eustace, I like their interactions. But in a different movie. Mm-hmm. But like looking back, watching Prince Caspian again, seeing Reepicheep, it doesn't, I don't dislike it as much. And I never disliked it that much to begin with. So it's like.
I think I might have the audio evidence that you did, in fact.
I didn't like. Okay, well, I mean, you can go back. It was 10 years ago, okay? So I'll
right, okay.
Plead whatever.
I'm sure you'll find something here with me, too, where it's, what? 10 years ago, you said you liked that. Or whatever. But yeah, I see what you're saying. I think that he is probably does come across as a touch too comedic. But I think as a fan of the book, and I'm going into this and going, oh, well, that's all. Reepicheep in the book, in the Prince Caspian book, is little more than kind of what the bulgy bear is. Oh, a bear that sucks in his paws. That's funny. And that's Reepicheep isn't that much more than that, in my opinion, in the Prince Caspian book. Then it's in the Dawn Treader book where he becomes so much more. So I think I was thought, oh, this is a really great start. Can't wait to see what they do with him in Dawn Treader. And they did nothing at all with him in Dawn. He's the heart of the book, and they did nothing with him in Dawn Treader.
I think most of it for me, it stems for I'm just like, not the biggest fan of Eddie Izzard's performance and I preferred, I believe it was Simon Pegg. I just preferred that, just that overall effect was, I liked it better for me.
Yeah, I remember it doing just nothing for me at all. Like Reepicheep, I remembered him, he left an impression on me in Prince Caspian. In Dawn Treader, I couldn't even really remember anything about him, which is, if there's, there you go. You want, why was Dawn Treader a bad adaptation? There you go. I could barely remember anything about Reepicheep. It's actually a part of the movie where he disappears for like 10 minutes, like 10, 15 minutes.
And I think
they,
just like,
couldn't afford, they like, couldn't afford to animate him or something.
That's funny. I was going to.
It's an interesting scene. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say this scene was.
Where Lucy claims that she just saw Aslan.
Yeah, I liked it.
It's okay. I think the acting is pretty good. I mean, it's faithful to the book in that the book never says, and Lucy saw Aslan. We just have Lucy claiming to have seen Aslan. So we as a reader have to make that leap of, well, we have to choose to trust Lucy, basically. I think most readers will.
Yeah.
So it's faithful to the book in that sense. And I like Peter looking back and forth and struggling to make that decision. So yeah, I think this is reasonably successful.
And I have to go out on, well, not go out on a limb, but like as someone who did tons and tons and tons of like graphic art with stuff from the movie, I love the visuals of this
Spareroom.net.
Movie is
yes.
Amazing. Like the colors, the design, mm-hmm.
The cinematography is great.
Oh, it's beautiful. It just makes my heart happy.
It's definitely, again, everything about it feels a lot more confident in itself than The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Wardrobe felt a little, visually just felt a little more safe and generic to me. And this feels like a movie that's trying to be something. So something specific. We have another stump question. Name two of the fawns dancing at the romp on the dancing lawn. One of them is Dumbness. I know that. I actually got this stump question in one of the episodes, and that's how I know one of them is Dumbness. I don't think I can do another one.
I don't know. I'm failing at these today, y'all.
Yeah. Maybe I'll try to.
You ought to ask me some movie stump questions, and yeah, then I'll be like, I got you there.
Good. How about some movie stump questions then? Or some gymnastics questions?
Bonus round. Dumbness is an awful name, says Leah. As when you say it out loud, yes, I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Leah says, I think Dumbness was actually on board the Dawn Treader, which would be appropriate enough. That's all I'll say.
Centaurs. I like.
Then there's some question. We got the dancing lawn scene going on right now. This is the first set I went to, by the way. I think this was almost done. Were they about to start filming, or were they finished? I can't remember. Menti, yes, that is correct. That is another font. Sorry for future podcast listeners reading the comments section here. Another stump question from Coracle. What were the first foods eaten by the Pevensies when they arrived and by Caspian?
Well, apples.
Would have been the apples. What about Caspian? Like arrived where? Were you asking, Coracle?
I know they had, didn't they have their sandwiches?
Oh, you're right. They had the sandwiches. I'm wrong. That you got it. No, you're right. They forgot in the book. That's right. They eat their.
Sandwiches. Like, they have something with them, and it was like we have to eat them now because they're going to spoil.
Yep, Leah got that one.
And then they had apples,
you
or
are
maybe
correct.
They ate them together. I don't remember exactly.
I totally forgot about that. So this scene, they're introducing some conflict here that's not in the book at all of the Narnians being reluctant to choose Caspian, which I understand in cinematic terms wanting to create some more conflict there. But it's such a half-hearted effort. It's like, well, why don't we have them say, we can't have Caspian, and then like a minute later,
whatever. It's like, it's
so,
all right.
I understand wanting to create more conflict, but it seems like such a half-hearted attempt to create conflict.
I think it's more... I don't think if they were necessarily trying to create conflict, it was more... maybe wanting to address an obvious elephant in the room and being like, if we've already established that these Telmarines
the
are bad and no one likes them, why would they just be like, oh yeah, Caspian,
that's fair,
we like you, come on in.
That's fair, but I think if you're gonna introduce this seemingly really difficult obstacle only to solve it 2 minutes later, it kind of loses a lot of its dramatic power.
Yeah, a bit.
But I understand.
But they're like...
I agree, Reaptube 775, Glenstorm is really cool.
Yes, I love the centaurs in this movie. I think they were a big improvement.
Still the best movie centaurs ever done. Easily.
Yeah.
And Coracle's asking the sandwich... what did Trumpkin catch and what did he shoot? Well, he shot an apple in the shooting competition, and he caught fish to feed the Pevensies in the book, as I recall. And Coracle saying, Caspian in the movie was given one food by Truffle Hunter, and in the book the details are different.
Oh, I don't remember.
Given food. I mean, soup? It was soup, wasn't it? I spent half the morning on that soup.
In the movie,
like
it was soup.
It was soup. Oh, that's a good point. Dot saying that the trees kind of groan as they're being cut down, which I think was taken from Lord of the Rings. The trees, they kind of do that too.
Yeah. They're like, well, if the trees are alive, then let's establish.
What do you think of this here? This is obviously different from the book because this is the part of the book where, some of them can see Aslan. Some of them can see Aslan, and some cannot.
Yeah.
And they don't do that at all here in the movie. I mean, yeah, it's the same idea that she went this way because she saw Aslan, and because of that, she found this secret, this secret path or whatever. So it's still there. You could argue conceptually it's still there. This just obviously isn't nearly as evocative as what's in the book. I understand the challenge of trying to shoot something like that, whereas some can see him and some can't. And I understand they would have to come up with something really creative, and I would have liked to have seen that. I don't know.
Yeah.
The book is so, so character driven all the way through.
Yeah.
And this has a lot of character stuff in it, but is largely narrative driven.
I'm just going to hop in there for a second. Becca in the comments says that river is way too blue. I'm going to go and say, not so. I have been to places where there was rivers where they were that blue. So that it does exist in real life.
I was showing a friend the trailer for Prince Caspian. And they were pausing at the single combat scene, and they said, oh, look how green the grass is. Oh, that's all visual effects. It's really not that green. And I went, no, I'm pretty sure it's that green.
I was there.
That actual spot.
I've been to places in Taiwan where where the rivers really are that color, and it's amazing.
Oh, Coracle is laughing at me and saying, hunting for apple. Have you ever been hunting for apples with your bow and arrow? Nope, something larger and hairier. Okay, so Trumpkin shoots the bear.
Right?
Is that what Is that what we're getting at?
I mean,
but
he
come
does.
On, technically I'm right. You said, what did Chumpkin shoot first? And he shot an apple first in the shooting competition. Get the question right.
This scene in the movie is kind of this scene plus the one before it is kind of the movie's compromise for the book scene where.
Sorry. That's a good point, Becca. Really quick.
Oh, yeah.
He does miss the apple. He doesn't actually shoot it. I'm sorry. That is correct. Good point.
Yes.
All right.
I remember when they were coming out with this movie, and I was like, if they don't have the scene in the book where, like, they're having to kind of walk by faith and follow Aslan, even if they're not seeing him, I was like, if that's not in there, I'm going to be really mad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not in the movie. But what they do have is they kind of have a different – it's
they have
do
the
it
basic
in different ways.
Beats. Yeah, they have the basic beats, which is that they have to – Lucy saw Aslan over here. Let's go this way. Oh, I guess Aslan was right. We have to go this way.
Yeah.
So they have that aspect of it.
But it's not quite the same.
No, it's not as evocative and not quite as character-driven, I guess. I mean, the reason for it is, again, in the book, this is like we're about to get into the third act in the book. And really, I can't emphasize this point enough. Think about it for a moment. We're watching Lucy's dream right now, by the way, looking at the dryads. But in the book, we're almost into the third act here. Aslan, it's time for Aslan to come to the rescue.
Yeah.
In the movie, we're not even halfway through.
Yeah.
Like, if the real conflict hasn't even quite been established yet. It's not time for Aslan to come to the rescue. If Aslan comes to the rescue now, the movie's an hour long. So it's more, I think that's why they made it a dream.
Yeah.
I don't totally object to the idea of being a dream for a number of reasons. First off, the idea of if you're going to tell a linear Prince Caspian story, then yeah, you have to find a way to delay Aslan's return until it's time, until Peter has completed his character arc. I also think the scene in the book has a very dreamlike quality to it.
Yeah.
And I think I wish they'd take advantage of that more. I guess they would give it away. I guess they don't want it to, I guess they kind of want it to be a surprise that it's a dream, but I wish they made this feel even more dreamlike. And I think it creates a sense of, in terms of adaptation, I think this, the more I think about it, the more I think this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does.
In terms of adaptation, it's like we're stepping back in time for a moment and saying, this is the way that Narnia used to be, the way it used to look. And then, boom, it cuts. Lucy wakes up, and this is the way it looks now. It's dead and it's motionless.
Yeah.
So that's a great way of translating an idea in the book into something visual. I think this is good adaptation here overall.
Yeah, and I think that's why I don't hate the fact that it's different. Because originally I thought it was going to be a deal breaker for me that if that particular scene was any different, I was not going to be happy. But because of the way they did it and all those explanations that you gave are really true and they make sense. And so I think that's why I don't hate it as much. And I do love how it does build up Aslan a lot more, where by the time he actually shows up towards the end of the movie, you're like, this is what we've been waiting for.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily saying I okay with the fact that they've cut out the idea from the book of some being able to see Aslan and some being invisible. I wish they'd kept that in somehow.
Yeah.
But there's other decisions that I think I understand why they made them, and I think that they have some merit. They have some merit to them.
Yeah, you have to make choices for a film because the way that you tell the story is going to be a little bit different because it's just a different medium. And so you lose some things and then you get things gained in other ways. So
what do you think about there's a handful of people in the comment section talking about first off, the dryads. What do you think of the way they did the dryads in the movie? Lewis talks about sometimes they looked like trees that were sort of people-ish and sometimes they look like people that are slightly tree-ish.
I think
really quick, Reaper Cheap 775 is asking who is Magician's Nephew dedicated to, and it was dedicated to the Kilmer family. And I know that because I'm working on a page for Narnia Web about the book dedications right now.
There you go.
Good timing. Anyway, sorry. What do you think of the dryads?
The dryads, they're not what I envisioned in the book, but they're fairly consistent across the board in the movies. And I don't think it's a bad interpretation. It's just I don't really have strong feelings either way.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I know some people do have strong. Oh, I hate the dryads. And some people really like them. I think for the most part, technically speaking, yeah, they look like trees and that they're like petals, but they're also in the shapes of people. So you could argue that okay, that's what Lewis wrote. It's like, I think it's faithful to Lewis's description in every way except it's boring. It's faithful in every way except the book is so evocative. It captures my imagination. And just CG flower petals flying around just doesn't capture my imagination at all. It's a tall order, I understand, trying to live up to Lewis's description there. But I think it's a little disappointing.
I remember when the trailer came out and there was a bit with Caspian and Peter fighting and everyone was freaking out. And then some of us were like, guys, it's like 9 out of 10. It's like a case of mistaken identity or misunderstanding.
That's
right. That's what
it
ended up being.
We were desperately trying to figure out.
I was like, guys, we see them fighting. Right. Don't worry.
I think it was a behind the scenes thing where we saw them, Peter and Caspian, fighting. Why are they fighting? And we had every theory imaginable. And mistaken identity was one of the... Remember, one theory was that they were fighting to decide who would fight Miraz. And then someone speculated, what if they're fighting over Susan? That was like one of our worst nightmare scenarios, that trying to defend Susan's honor or something like that. I don't know. Stay away from my sister.
We were like, what with that? Oh, my goodness.
But
wow.
I don't mean, like, mistaken identity, I guess, is what is like... Of all the things we thought it might be, yeah, that's the least offensive. But it's still annoying seeing High King Peter and Caspian going at it. And I don't know. I just feel all yucky from this. I don't like it.
Oh.
And that's all I had to say. question. AJ Aiken's asking, this is always the moment I wonder how Trumpkin knew who Caspian was. But did he necessarily know who Caspian was right away? I mean, he sees all the other Narnians and Nicobrick and people he does know come around. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. I see what AJ's saying. Wait, I get all confused. Somehow, yeah, early in the scene when Caspian is... Sorry, when... Trumpkin's being interrogated by Miraz. Doesn't he suggest... Oh, no, because Miraz says something like, I will find Prince Caspian or something like that. And then Trumpkin hears Miraz say that, and he kind of puts it together. Oh, there's this Prince Caspian that's out there. So wait a minute, maybe that does make sense.
Yeah.
Too bad this is live, guys, or I would feel like I was...
Well, hold that thought. We'll look into it. Yeah. But yeah, it would... He does catch on extremely quickly, but Trumpkin was always fairly observant, so maybe I'll just chalk it up to he's a smart guy between being captured by the Telmarines and being with the Pevensies.
It's loose. It's
he's
a loose
like,
explanation, but
he
kinda I guess
figured
it
out,
works.
But yeah. They make Mira such a villain. Like, I love...
Sergio Castellito's great.
Yes, I love the character the character development in terms of setting up was like, this is a bad dude.
Mm-hmm.
He is bad news. The
political intrigue.
And this aspect of the movie I love because it gives him motivation. Like, you already understand, like, you know, he's doing this for his son, but he's also, like, a bad dude.
He believes he's actually... Sergio Castellito, at least when I interviewed him, we actually needed a translator because he just doesn't speak English very well, which is amazing. Looking at this, you would never know that.
Yeah. So, acting and you learned the part, and maybe you're not going to be good at interviews, but you're great at this part, and that it's a great part.
It's cool as a contrast to the White Witch, who has a wand and can turn people into stone, and her threat is very physical and immediate. And Miraz is more of, he's just really smart. He's a great manipulator.
Yeah, definitely.
I like that contrast. He's kind of the Lex Luthor of Narnia.
Yeah. They did excellent, excellent villain work. And it really makes that end, that duel between him and Peter very, like, you get scared for Peter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You're like,
yeah,
he may not make it out of this. And I think because you're able to get that moment, get that feeling, like, the whole thing works.
Right. Pretty much everything, like, there's a lot of things in the movie that they expanded on from the book. Miraz is one of the most notable ones, and the one that pretty much every area where they fleshed out Miraz, I think, was really successful.
Yeah. And this part for me, I remember looking at the set pictures for this, you know, because that's, you know.
Oh, yeah. I've been there.
That's Aslan's table, and it's like, but that's not where it was in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It's totally different geography. It doesn't look anything like it. It just, like, magically picked itself up and moved somewhere else.
Right. That's E.T.'s Mucindan's son right there, the little centaur. Yeah. The costume designer.
Oh, I love the centaurs. I'll say that again. But yeah, took a little artistic liberties with some of their geographical consistency.
Movie Aristotle was not able to take pictures. I think I would have been jumped by 5 security guys. If
right.
I did, however, sneak a rock.
Dun, dun, dun. And now Disney's going to be knocking on your door.
But you can't tell anybody. Don't tell all of you. Don't tell anybody.
And then finding the etchings.
My favorite scene in the movie is coming up here. I'm not sure, Marcus, if you're referring to the scene right here with the carvings on the wall. That's my favorite scene in the movie, what we're looking at right now. This is the coolest idea in the Prince Caspian book, I think, is that they are, to the Narnians, they're like figures out of their bedtime stories come to life.
Yeah.
And seeing Tumnus, this character we know was a good friend of Lucy's, carved on the wall, like he's some fairy tale character, is an awesome idea. It's amazing. When they shot that, it was like a centaur or something. They got the idea in post that it could be Tumnus. And it's like, how could it be any other way? This is a cool shot of them in the darkness and the torches filling it.
Yeah, I can't be too mad about the set inconsistency when you get an awesome set like this. And it's just like, oh, it is very cool.
Can you imagine, like Rose is pointing out, can you imagine seeing yourself carved on a wall? You know that it's been 1,000 years.
Can't.
I love that idea. Oh, that's it's so. This exact scene is. Here's a good example of adaptation. This exact scene is not in the Prince Caspian book, but this scene is in terms of capturing what Prince Caspian is all about. This is a phenomenal scene. This is why I love the Prince Caspian book is embodied in this scene.
Mm-hmm. And I love the carving of Aslan. It's like when the girls first see him after he comes back and it's just like it.
Mirrors that.
Yeah.
Andrew Adamson, I think very often he kind of drags out his reveals, like the wardrobe for a bit, a little too much. But this is a moment where I think he did a really good job revealing the room. The fire goes around the room. We see Aslan. We see the reaction, the carvings, and finally we see the stone table. It's a really well blocked out scene. It's a good point, Marcus. Marcus is saying, I forgot how much of this film is practical. Like you watch this compared to a lot of the blockbusters today, and it's sort of shocking how, wow, it all looks so real compared to the cartoon green screen stuff we usually get today.
Bet that made for great set visits. You go on a set visit, it's all green screen. It's like, woo!
Yeah, exactly. Have you seen the before and afters of George Lucas? It says like it has like a George Lucas from the 80s, and it's just like a whole bunch of models and stuff behind him. And then George Lucas today, and it's just a green wall behind him.
Yeah, basically.
Oh, here's my favorite scene in the movie, actually. I have to take it back right here. Of the Fawn discovering the spy, because they shot this scene in order to so they could delete the Caspian Susan flirting scene. Because at the end of the flirting scene, they discover the spy. When they cut that out, they had to film another way to do that.
And so that's how we got the dude with a nice beard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ReaperCheap775 pointing out that Don Treader has a lot more CGI than Prince Caspian. And Don Treader was also shot digitally and doesn't have the tactile reality that the first two movies had. Even in scenes in Don Treader where it is all real, it just feels more fake. It just this one feels so...
Well, some of that you knew was going to happen because they're on a ship and shooting on water is not practical. It's very difficult. So you knew it was going to happen, but still...
Right.
And here we go. Headbutting commence.
This doesn't bother me as much because I understand it's a stressful situation. And, of course, in the book talks about how there were short tempers. I read that scene this morning, actually. There were short tempers in the army, and Wimbleweather stepped on someone's tail, and everybody was just pissed off and in a bad mood. And I understand this is a stressful situation, and they all have some strong opinions. So... this scene doesn't bother me too much. Mosley's performance is still a bit much, I guess, but especially at this point in the movie where it's time to really push the story forward to its next act and say, what are we going to do? And it's a question of do we try to continue to rely on Aslan, or do we try to take matters into our own hands? Which is an idea that's in the book.
Mm.
And here they're dramatizing it. And I wish Mosley would pull back a little bit on his performance so it wasn't such a brat. But
yeah.
I like where they're going with the scene.
I think in the movie, the choice was made to, instead of, like, they wanted to add, they wanted them to hit rock bottom, and they wanted to make it very obvious and very
and that happens
emotional when that happens. And so that's why, instead of them just talking about stuff, but then ultimately going with the end plan, they try something else. It fails. It just brings it more into perspective. We need Aslan. Like, we can't do this. We tried. Didn't work.
A couple things from the comments. Kay McQuaid, Kevin, is saying, oh, where'd it go? I lost it. Oh, Caspian's saying, you don't know about the stone table room. And had Caspian know. Well, I figure Caspian's been there for a while, I think. That's the sense I get. Caspian's been at the howl for a while waiting for the Pevensies. So he'd already looked around and seen that. A lot of people are talking about Reepicheep saying shut up to Patter Twig. Your thoughts on that, Jim Fan?
That just seems consistent with his characterization in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Which, take it as you will.
I guess. I understand why people dislike it, and I would have to largely agree, I guess. It didn't jump out at me, but yeah, I can understand how it's out of character. At least from the book, certainly. I got another stump question from Marcus. Can you name the dwarfs that took in Shasta and the horse and his boy?
Nope.
One of them is Thornbutt. I don't think I can come up with the other ones. The Night Raid. Here we go. Here is where everyone has to choose sides and either go left or right on whether or not you liked the Night Raid.
I like the Night Raid.
Reepicheep775 likes the Night Raid. I think I generally do like the Night Raid. The only thing I don't love about the Night Raid is, again, Mosley's performance. I find just way too reckless and bratty. But
the concept,
overall,
the concept, I think, works.
Like, thematically, in terms of character, I like the idea of them saying, we need to take matters into our own hands. We can't wait for Aslan anymore. And that's the big decision that leaves them at their lowest point going into the third act. So it makes a lot of sense. I like that Peter still has this idea in his head of, I'm the High King. I can go do this on my own. And he's picturing the Narnia from 1,300 years ago. It's this fairy tale Narnia, and things have gotten a more morally black and white Narnia. And he comes here where, I didn't think things like this could happen. And I think that's the look on his face when he has to leave all those people behind.
Yeah.
He's realizing, oh, Narnia is different. And that's the tragedy, that the Narnia that we know from the other movie is gone.
I think it just kind of goes in with what we were saying earlier, like, you know, you may find Narnia a more savage place than you remember, where it's like, yeah, bad things happened before, but now, like, for the audience, we need to be emotional. Like, we need to understand that on an emotional level so we can understand the character's motivation. And I think it makes the third act of the movie so much more potent, because it's like you've seen them go through trying other things. You've seen them fail. You've seen them suffer. And suddenly there's no guarantee that they're going to go into this battle and they're going to come out on top, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's where you get where Peter goes out to duel and you're like, oh, crap, he might die, you know?
I'm about to start kind of disliking the movie. Up to this point, whenever I – like, everything you said, I really agree with. I think that they do a good job of setting up the third act, and when you finally get to the third act, it just doesn't work for me. But whenever I watch the movie, I usually get to about the Night Raid or just after, and I'm like, why don't I love this movie?
It's because you get to the White Witch, start hating it.
But it's not just because of the book, though. There's a lot of reasons why the White Witch, I think, scene signals it's like the movie does a really good job setting up that third act, and then it doesn't know what to do when it finally gets there. So, well, I guess there's a sword fight, and I guess there's a battle, and I guess they can kiss at the end, whatever. It feels like they didn't quite know how to end it, so they just did everything.
You and I can deal with Miraz.
And I can still get to the gate in time.
And then just... man, I remember seeing the previs for the Night Raid at Comic-Con, and it was just the opening bit. So it was like Edmund on the Eagle and like just that bit and everyone just being like, what is this? What is going on? But it looked cool even as a previs.
The cat being tied up. I don't know. I love how they just like step. Bubba Jeep has no problem like killing Telmarine soldiers, but when they come to a cat, they'd have to tie it up.
Yeah, I cannot kill the cat.
It's bad luck or something. I don't know. But Leah is talking about the PG-13 rating and saying, I almost wish the movie could have had a PG-13 rating so there could be a somewhat more violent battle. I think this movie probably should have been PG-13. It's this movie gets about as close as you can possibly, at least it gets as close as you can possibly get. I think they managed to, I don't know. I think the PG rating was a good limitation in this sense. I think we get the, it put more pressure on them to convey the emotional weight.
Yes, instead
of losing soldiers and such, and how Narnia has changed, rather than just being able to necessarily rely on just showing dead bodies or something.
Yeah, which I totally agree with, and I think it works really well. You don't need gore to disturb people. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now sometimes maybe you do.
Sometimes you do, but in some things you don't, and. Yeah. I think this works in getting the emotional weight across.
It's more about what has happened to the spirit of Narnia, if that makes any sense. Then it's not that, oh, soldiers have taken over Narnia. It's that it's really about all the trees are asleep and things happen that it's a more complicated world. It doesn't feel like simple good and evil anymore. It doesn't feel as black and white anymore. And that feels wrong. That's not the Narnia I know from the other movie. And I think that the emphasis on that, it works just fine here. So I think they get away with it. Sorry, I'm actually watching the scene.
I know. I
should be saying something. forgot about this scene.
Caspian and Miraz, you killed my father. Prepare to die.
Dare to die. She was literally quoting that to himself on the drive to his audition, which isn't the most shocking thing, I guess.
And it just shows, I think this scene shows Miraz as a manipulator even more, and just like how he can just talk his way out of this and just play to all of Caspian's insecurities and fears in order to save his own skin.
It's a damn cheesy scene, but Sergio Castellito is so great.
Yeah.
That makes me kind of enjoy this. And his performance, now when he starts to walk towards Caspian and his neck starts bleeding, which I didn't notice in theaters, that's really cool. I love how Caspian's pushing against him here, and then Sergio is just going to push right back on him. And I love the back and forth
great?
Here. It's cheesy. Like the whole,
did
you kill my father is really cheesy.
Yep.
There's no question. And the whole...
But we love it anyway, because look at it.
I don't love it. Don't put words in my mouth, Sam fan. But I love Sergio's performance. I think he saves the scene and makes it watchable. And at least it's dramatically interesting. But maybe if we had seen Caspian and Miraz together and they had established more of a relationship, the scene could work a lot better. We infer they had a relationship, but we never actually see it. Yeah, and I agree, Marcus. Caspian's accent's kind of out of control in this scene.
Yeah.
It's not very consistent. And again, he...
channeling.
Poe Edmund playing with his torch and loses it.
It's like, dang you, Edmund,
bro.
It's all your fault.
Be a king.
It's actually not Edmund's fault. It just... Yeah. this is all when it starts to just go horribly wrong.
Yep.
And they're like, ooh.
Glenstorm is so cool.
Oh, dear.
I wish we got to develop Glenstorm a little bit more. I know he just has a couple scenes in the book, but they're really memorable scenes. He's such a cool character. Can we get a Glenstorm spinoff at some point?
But, yeah.
And I think this battle is well paced and it's well told, and that you really get a good sense of, oh, the odds are against them. They're having to sneak around. And, maybe they have a chance now. Uh-oh, now things are going off the rails and things are going bad. You have a really clear sense of, like, the way the battle unfolds. It's not just people swinging swords at each other, but there's a very clear unfolding story. And it's all tied to Peter and Caspian's character. Yeah, Becca. Caspian's, why is Caspian not bleeding out? It's the whole stormtrooper thing.
It's a flesh wound.
you know, Chewie can get shot in the arm, whatever, but a stormtrooper gets anywhere close to a blaster and they just fall over.
He's just like, just dead.
I was wondering about the bear, by the way. The bear gets shot with an arrow. I know it's basically right in the heart, but it just immediately falls over and he's dead,
like,
silent.
I feel like that's not how it works in real life, but I'm like, I don't hunt, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan is just like, annoyed with Peter right now.
Uh-huh.
Just
I don't think
is wrong with you? Let's just go.
I just think they could have done this better with knowing that Peter is making a bad choice, but understanding it at the same time. I think we don't get it. I think we think that Peter is psycho in this scene.
Yeah.
That's the one aspect that keeps me from really loving the Night Raid.
And I think there's
a lot of aspects of it I appreciate.
Yeah. And I think what you say about it just perhaps being more of the performance is probably correct. Like, maybe this role in the hands of someone else, it would have come across completely differently. And not to drag on William Moseley, because love the guy, but it would have been interesting to see another person's interpretation if with the same scenes and the same lines would have been able to give it a different feeling,
right?
And more sympathy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I appreciate the fact that they took a risk with Moseley by giving him more acting to do and giving him a more difficult role. He has the most difficult role in the movie.
Yeah, for sure.
I appreciate that they played it very safe, I think, with the kids' performances in the first movie. They, with just a couple exceptions, they didn't ask for too much of them. Like, they didn't ask them to really see character development that much, just in their performance. It was all on the page. Here, a lot of it is in the performance. They really relied on William to do that. And unfortunately, I don't think he came through, but I appreciate them taking the risk.
Yeah. Because sometimes you can do that with other people, and I've always loved Scander's interpretation of Edmund. I think there's, the nuance comes across, and I think a lot of that is just in him as a person, just like, that comes across in his character.
Yeah. It's a shame that he doesn't have more to do in this movie.
Yeah.
I think Skander Keynes is the best. I mean, Georgie was just born to play Lucy.
Yeah, she is Lucy, basically.
But Skander Keynes, I actually hope, here's a good one. When Wardrobe first came out, I predicted that of the four, Skander Keynes would be the one that would go on and have an actual acting career.
He has so much promise.
And as it turns out, he's the only one that did nothing at all after Narnia. So I was totally wrong on that one.
But it wasn't for lack of ability. Let's just put it that way. Skander, if you ever decide to come back to acting, that would be a great choice. But otherwise, you do you, man.
Yep. This is Sparta.
Ugh. You're just like, Mirez, again. He's just not a great dude.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all like, oh, crap, this is really, 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 really not going well. We got to get out of here.
Not to pick on William again, I'm sorry, but also he's not a very good sword fighter. and again, Skander Keynes, and again, William has more to do, but whenever Skander does a stunt, it really looks very convincing, whereas William just never, it looks like he's playing, I don't know, he looks like he's playing whenever he uses the sword. And Caspian, too, but again, Ben was shooting like a few days after getting off the plane to New Zealand. So anyway, that sword fight with Edmund and Trumpkin, it looks really legit.
Yeah.
And a lot of this stuff, you feel like, I don't know, they look more like they're dancing than fighting. Sorry, William. I guess we haven't seen, Moonlight Centaur points out that Anna Popplewell has kind of disappeared.
She was doing a TV show for a long time. It only recently got canceled, but that was on, what was it, HBO or Star?
Yeah, she did a Halo thing as well. She was kind of in little
random
roles.
So she's been doing
roles,
stuff, just not
but,
movies.
Yes, Skander and, Georgie and William are still around doing stuff. And here comes, here's the big stunt that William wouldn't stop bragging about. On the set. And I remember thinking, like, wow, I can't wait to see this. The way you described it sounded so crazy when he jumps on the horse here, and then it's kind of over before you know it, which I guess is filmmaking in a nutshell, right?
Right. You work on something for weeks and weeks, and then it's like,
and it's
3 seconds.
Over like that. And here comes the scene that, in a sense, either like where they're trapped inside Where either you like it or you hate it. Now, no one likes it in the sense that I don't think anybody's going, yeah, this is cool. But basically, whether or not you object to it being in the movie or not, I guess is the question. And I think it's a heartbreaking scene that I think is very effective and gets to the heart of what Caspian's about.
I think
I like it.
I think it's a great addition. And some people are like, you cannot, you know, add or remove one shot from the books. And I'm like, it's a movie. Like, if for the interpretation of the book that you're doing, the adaptation, if you need to add something in order to make that come to life, then go ahead and do it. And I think this works. So I have no objection.
Rose Tree says, the heartbreak is the main reason why I like the Night Raid concept. It really drives home the despair and desperation for the Narnians, I think. There you go. Anyone else in the comments section, what do you think about having this in the movie where they have to, William the King is forced to leave behind a bunch of his followers, basically. And some people don't like that, too. Some people say the High King should have just stayed and died. He's the first in every desperate charge, the last in every retreat.
And I think he hates it as much as, you know, like, you can...
It's a complicated decision.
Yeah.
That you don't expect to ever have to be in this position in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe version of Narnia. This is a more... It's almost like the good and evil and black and white, it isn't quite so simple anymore.
Yeah.
And there's something heartbreaking about that loss of innocence.
Leah says, so that's why there are Minotaurs in the movie. They needed some strong Narnians to hold gates. Not wrong.
That was controversial, by the way, when they... Because, again, it's Narnia, for the most part, with just a couple exceptions, like dwarves. For the most part, it's very... The Minotaurs are the bad guys. The Centaurs are the good guys. And the Fauns are the good guys. And it's very clear-cut. But so having Minotaurs be on the good guy side was a thing we talked about. We knew that very early on. They had a production blog about it.
Yeah.
I guess I don't mind it that much. Yeah. I don't know.
They're saying in the chat that... out of Peter and Reep, Reepicheep definitely would have stayed.
That's a good point.
And I think, yes. And so I think even if they just showed someone, like, pick him up and, like, carry him out, I think that would have worked
have him
so
get
much
wounded.
Better.
Or have him get wounded or something.
Right?
So that,
but yes, he totally would have stayed. He would not have left.
Heck, and you know what? He would have won, too.
Yes.
The movie would be over right there. He would have just taken all of them out. And I'd be fine with that. Can we have an alternate version of the scene where Reepicheep just does a Neo and just takes... Oh, like Neo versus 100 Agent Smith, the Matrix Reloaded. He just takes out all of them. Now, here is... Yeah, we actually saw this clip of Peter and Caspian arguing before the movie came out. And that was... Like, we knew there was going to be tension between them. I don't think we thought it was going to... come to this. I'm drawing swords on each other and shouting at each other. I don't like this. It doesn't work. I understand the tension. I understand the emotions that have come from all those creatures just dying. I'm almost talking myself into it right now.
It's maybe more the execution. It's not the idea. It's maybe the way it was executed that doesn't work quite as well. Maybe is that what you're getting at?
I suppose so. This might just be the fan of the book in me saying, okay, come on, Peter. It's time to hand your sword to Caspian and hand the kingship to Caspian. It's just them drawing swords on each other is just cheesy.
Yeah.
And Reepicheep 775 is saying it's cringy. Totally agree with that.
It's one
thing to shout at each other. It's when they draw swords on each other. It's like, come on, guys.
So sad when the mom is like, you see, like, there's personal consequences.
Yep,
for dumb decisions, dude.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so sad.
Little beat here of a Lucy Trumpkin relationship that's kind of bubbling a little bit throughout the movie. That's pretty effective, I think.
Yeah.
There's a couple of moments they have, but at the end when you know they have the hug and they leave, you kind of feel like I don't really know what it is, but it feels like they had something.
I think that the idea behind, you know. They needed Caspian to get to the place where he was going to even consider the, you know, entertain the thought of Nicobrick's idea. They needed to get Caspian to the point where he hit rock bottom, because at this point we've seen Peter hit rock bottom, right? Like, that was totally, that was like on him. He screwed, you know, that was his idea. It screwed up. That was a bad thing. But Caspian, he hasn't quite got there yet. So the whole, to me, the White Witch thing is Caspian getting to that point where he's like, I just, that was not a good thing. And I need Aslan. I cannot do this by myself. So the concept I understand, but like, yeah, the execution is not quite right. But the concept I get.
Oh, darn it. I didn't post a link to this on Facebook. I meant to. Let me post a link to the watch party on Facebook right now. I saw you did. Thank you.
I love the music in this, and it's just like, whoop, there's a lot of people coming. Yep. You guys are in big
and
trouble.
Cue the third act.
Yes.
This is like, this is pretty effective, I think, establishing how the odds are stacked against them. And this, now we've turned a corner here, and it's downhill from here. The movie as a whole. It's not that it's horrible, but we've seen the best. Oh, yeah, Dot was talking about the locations. That they're shouting in the background, like, Ettensmore pledges its troops. And I just never thought of Ettensmore as a place that would have troops. I should think about that more, but that just seemed a little odd.
And here's the part that everyone's like,
yeah.
Oh, boy. I'll say
this. I tried to play it cool in Prague when we were looking at concept art. We were looking at concept art and just saying different things like, oh, what's this? What's this? Asking questions, blah, blah, blah. Then I saw the White Witch and tried to play it cool. Was like, so, why is there a White Witch over there? I was trying to play it really cool. And they actually started talking like, oh, yeah, they come back. And then our publicist interrupted. It was like, oh, no, stop. Don't stop. Can't say anything else.
Because she's like, those people from Narnia Web are over there and they're going to freak out.
And we're hoping, well, maybe it's just for a quick flashback or something. Maybe. And then when the trailer came out, it was, no, it's everything we were fearful of.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I think I've said this before. I don't object to this scene on...
It, visually, I think it's the best scene in the movie.
Yeah, and I don't object to this scene even from a character standpoint, because Caspian's not a willing participant in this, so it's not like he's like, yeah, White Witch, woo woo. I mean, because kind of once he kind of figures out what's going on, he's not really into that. And so that works for me. I'm okay with that. And I do love how it ends, where it's like, it kind of hammers home Aslan. To me, that's what I got out of it.
I see what they're going for. And Reaper 775 saying doesn't really mind the witch coming back. I guess I just find the way it's done cheesy. I wish I could put my finger on exactly what it is, but maybe just the dialogue in the book and the speculation about what to do next is just so much more interesting than this. And they're trying very hard to dance around the fact, the way they do this in the movie, you can tell they really don't want Caspian to be in the wrong. They don't want him to fully know what he's getting into. They want him to be innocent. And to me, it's just not quite believable that when he say, like, whoa, what the heck are you guys doing? You know, I just don't buy he would just kind of go along with it. So I've as a viewer, I've just lost track of what Caspian is thinking and feeling here. I think that's a big reason why this doesn't work for me. As on a human level, I don't get what they're doing. Why are they making these
decisions? To me, it's like, I see that he's someone, he wouldn't have really grown up with stories of the White Witch because he didn't really grow up with stories of Narnia whatsoever. So I see someone
but
who doesn't
they're
really
doing,
quite
like, sticking the,
get
but as they're sticking the
on.
Wand to the ground and drawing the circle, wouldn't he just be like, what are you guys doing?
Yeah, but like a lot of
he's like, whatever.
A lot of the Narnia he's been exposed to up until that point has been like, oh, what's going on? So to me, I'm like, it's not outside the realm of reason of him not quite understanding that this is the
same
bad
thing
stuff.
Same thing with Peter for me, though. It's just, I'm not with him psychologically. I don't get exactly, like, I'd be like, what the heck are you guys doing? What's up with the black chalk or whatever? I don't know. I just think the way it's staged doesn't feel truthful to me. And, of course, this is the maybe the best dialogue scene in the series when they're speculating about whether or not...
Oh, that's so cool.
It's kind of a neat effect of the hand coming out there. Again, visually, it's very cool. I just think it loses the human element for me. You know, Amanda, you've got a point. Compared to what they did with The Witch in the Dawn Treader movie.
This is nothing by comparison.
This is freaking Stanley Kubrick compared to that.
And I do love how Edmund is able to kind of, you know, be in the participant.
Yeah,
in this
finally
again.
Get to do something.
Yeah. Well, and just, I know Edmund and the White Witch have always been them two, you know? And so he gets to play a part, like a big part in
every line that Skander has, he just nails.
Yes.
He makes it more than what it is on the page.
He is the quintessential Edmund to me, just like Will Poulter is Eustace to me.
I think he's a great actor. I'm really glad he was cast, but it's not like when I read the book, I still have my own vision of Edmund. Whereas Lucy, now when I read the book, I see a blonde Georgie Henley. It's like she's that she's Lucy. She's more Lucy than what I had in my head before I saw the movie. Like, she has just taken over what I think about Lucy. It is pretty amazing this got a PG rating.
Because it's like...
I understand there's a lot of PG films that will have a moment or two in there that really toe that line. But this has, like, 6 or 7 moments where it's like, whoa, they barely got it there. But whatever, the ratings are all so political.
Right. Because it's Disney, so they can do whatever they want.
Disney will get whatever they want.
That's like Edmund to the rescue again, because he's the only person who's got his head screwed on straight here, apparently.
Maybe the scene, you know what? Maybe dramatically the scene feels unnecessary. I feel like Peter already knew he made a mistake.
Well, I don't think this was really for Peter's sake. I think this was more for, this is for everyone getting back to, this is why we need Aslan, as opposed to, this is why we just need another good idea. Or we just need another idea.
I feel like the Night Raid achieved that. The Night Raid achieved the objective of that now's the time to wake up and we need to rely on Aslan, not ourselves. And so I guess dramatically, this scene feels redundant to me. It doesn't actually move the story.
In a way.
I feel like you could easily have dissolved from the argument after the Night Raid to this. Cornelius talking to Caspian, and I don't think you would miss anything. Maybe that's another reason why.
Except a really, very visually cool scene.
What's that? Oh, that's true. Yeah, again, visually it's the coolest scene in the movie.
And I think visually it's very powerful to see it go from the White Witch and then be like, oh yeah, there's Aslan. Like, instead of just coming out and saying Aslan, they don't talk about him at all, really. It's just, they show you rather than tell you. For me, I don't mind it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. You're wrong, but okay. it's just my opinion, but it's the right one.
I get that a lot.
A rare scene of Caspian and... Well, the only scene, really. Well, I guess we saw them at the beginning, but Caspian and Cornelius together, which, whatever. Cornelius is a whatever character in the movie.
He's the exposition. He serves a purpose. Such a cool shot.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I appreciate the fact that they have a few quiet scenes in a row here of just characters just wondering.
It's the calm before the storm.
The lull, exactly. I appreciate that. I don't know how well they work, but I appreciate that they're here. Looking through the Narnia News Archives, trying to find a nostalgic headline to put on the screen or something. Oh, I've got a good one here. Let me share my screen. Everybody, if you're not looking at the screen, look now. Here's a blast from March 15th, 2008.
Oh, boy.
Let me make that stop. I'm switching. Here we go. Let's see. MTV Movies blog. Sharp-eyed viewers for the new trailer, Prince Caspian, blah, 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 blah. So Prince Caspian, So this must have been Tilda Swinton screwing with us, because they asked Tilda Swinton about her being in the Prince Caspian trailer, and she said, I'm dead. I don't know what they're doing there.
She didn't say what are no. They she just said, very clever, but you
but
know,
look,
excuse
but then
me.
She says, they have my image in their computer bank. They can do whatever they want.
But she didn't say.
But she's totally screwing with
of
us.
Course,
she's totally.
Of course.
She's, sorry, if you're listening to the podcast in the future, I'm looking at a headline from March 2008. Where Tilda Swinton basically was asked about her appearance in the Prince Caspian trailer and basically tried to play it off. Like, no, I don't know anything about it. I don't know what's going on. Because we knew that she had visited the set. We had had pictures of her actually visiting the set. Then we went, oh, maybe she just went to visit? Maybe she didn't actually have a role in the movie, though? Okay.
Back to now, Prince Caspian.
Here's again. This doesn't work for me. So back to the movie here. They're on the whole. Oh, we've got to go find Aslan or whatever. What do they mean exactly? Like, why can't they just wait for Aslan inside the How? Why do they have to go off in this random? Oh, Bulgy Bear. Got a shout out to the Bulgy Bear.
poor Aslan.
But why do they have to like go find Aslan? What does that mean? Why do we have to go out into the middle of the woods and? Hope he'll show up. Why not just like wait here inside the How for Aslan to show up?
Yeah.
I
they don't really establish
for.
Why someone has to go.
And go where?
It's,
and
they
why.
Just say, well, they have. It's kind of like in Dawn Treader where they're like, we must find the seven swords and lay them on the table. And it's like, but why?
But why?
But why?
This, on the other hand, is cool.
Yes.
I love the fact that the single combat, I think this is straight up an improvement on the book.
This is so, I love this scene.
What scene?
This.
Oh, coming up. Okay. Yes. We don't want to talk about this. So really quick. I love the idea of the single combat being Caspian's idea because he had some insight into Telmarine culture that Peter wouldn't have. I think that's really, really cool. Mm-hmm. And in terms of film, it makes sense too to, gives Peter the opportunity to let Caspian take the lead because it makes sense. So I think that's just straight up an improvement on the book.
And also he...
You talk about this scene, though.
Oh, but just this scene, like, just coming and giving the summons and whatever. Oh, it's so great.
Again, Scander, every line of this is perfect.
It's like Scander, it's like Edmund and Miraz together. It's like, so good.
And this is a little different from... Because in the book, it's just Sepespian and Glazel, you know, working all this out. Edmund doesn't really speak a word to any of this. I think this is a great idea to have Edmund have a back and forth with Miraz. I will say, I don't like the whole, it's King Edmund, actually. I know, Peter's the High King. It's kind of confusing. I the kind of apologetic tone in his voice is the only thing I don't like about this scene. How about stand proudly on it and say, yeah, we've got multiple kings and queens. We're very different from you guys.
Like,
very
deal with
the Telmarines. We're very different from the Telmarines that have one king. And one dictator and usurper. Yeah, we're different from you guys. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. And stand on it proudly rather than be kind of apologetic about it. But gosh, the performances in here are really, really good. This is a great scene. Okay, now, it's not quite downhill. There's one more great scene here.
But like the manipulation, just the intrigue.
Uh-huh.
It's like how they are kind of goading him into doing it, you know?
Usually Miraz is the one manipulating other people, and now they're manipulating him. It's all coming back to him now. They're all manipulating him. Oh. Yeah, Amanda's saying talking about the apologetic tone in Edmund's voice. He just thought it was played for laughs, and maybe I guess I don't want that to be played for laughs.
For the audience, yes, but in that context, if that was like a real moment, then it's like, yeah, don't apologize.
Yeah, you could interrupt him and say, no, just King. Peter's the High King. I'm just the King, and maybe it's okay for the audience to laugh, but Edmund seemed like he was like, oh, this scene. I'm sorry, just totally interrupted my train of thought.
Every time. That's all right. When we get to that part, and you know what that part is, just shield your eyes, children.
Yep. If all of a sudden my internet mysteriously cuts out,
it's
because of all the negative energy surrounding me. Overloaded all the circuits in my computer.
I think the romance between Caspian and Susan is unnecessary. I don't hate it on, like, a spiritual level like you do. it's just, it doesn't do anything for me, but I don't like
it's so
hate
dumb.
It, hate it, hate
I mean, yeah, it's me as a fan of the book that really makes me hate it. But if I hadn't read the book, I'd just go, well, that's stupid.
I'm just like, man, whatever. Like, he's good looking, she's good looking. Like,
mm-hmm. And here is where I was actually here when they were filming this.
So if we look right into the very upper right left-hand corner.
Yep, only the shots where they're facing Peter and Edmund.
You can tell us what was the weather like that day.
I like them cheering on, like the Narnians cheering on, like a kind of the sporting event feel to it. I wish they had more of that. I wish they weren't so far removed. I wish the fighters weren't so far removed from the spectators. I wish they were closer. I don't know why they're so separated. And then this shot right here, Peter pulling out his sword. If you pan the camera to the left, I'm standing right there.
And right.
Pretty much made the scene.
Yep. That was you just behind the kid just being like, yes!
It's not quite as dramatic when they're all wearing green pajamas at their lower half.
Just use your imagination.
Yep. How do we feel about the Telmarine helmets? They cover their faces. It's kind of Stormtrooper style.
Creepy. They are useful for getting a PG rating.
Exactly. Again.
And they look creepy, so I mean, what? I'll take it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they look neat, and they're unique. It's gutsy, I guess, to cover up the face of a main character like Miraz.
Dun, dun,
I wonder how
dun.
Practical they are. And it protects your face, but also makes more difficult to see. I don't know. How practical would it be to have a heavy mask like that?
I don't think it's practical. I think it's movie practical, not real life practical. But someone can correct me. I don't know much about
I really
want to
watch this scene closely because, okay, this is cool. They're actually having a sword fight. Okay, everything after this is dumb in the single combat, in my opinion.
But Aslan.
You got to give the girls something to do, of course, because having them just be with Aslan during... Oh, I'm just remembering now all the scenes in the book they cut out of healing nurse and all the stuff that the Logos Theater did really well. The Logos Theater version fleshed out the whole nurse Caspian relationship in a way that was really effective.
Mm.
And this, they just completely nixed it here. That's unforgivable. I mean, they did the same thing in the wardrobe. They cut out pretty much all of Chapter 16, The Line, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, them restoring the statues. 99% of it is gone. And that's like the best stuff. That's some of the best stuff in the book.
I didn't connect with that as much when I read the book, so it didn't bother me as much that it wasn't in the movie. That it would have been cool to see, for sure. But that wasn't one of the things that I was like, man, I want to see that in the movie. There were other things that I got, so I was all
right. Interesting. But come on, when Caspian is reunited with Nurse... I'm like tearing up right now just thinking about it. I'm also tearing up because I'm not watching it right now in a movie. I'm watching Susan picking off Telmarines, and then Caspian's going to arrive here and take all the credit for killing one.
I mean, because that one was really important, guys.
Yep. We're going to have our strong female scene. And then, just kidding, we're not.
Just kidding. Caspian, to the rescue. Good job. You are a great king.
You know what you call Susan's armor there? Chain female. I'll be here all week, folks.
Oh, man.
No, too bad. It's live, so I can't cut
that out. I like
the
camera.
I'm regretting it already.
Here.
This is neat. Looks like they use a different shutter speed for this. It's got a really weird... trippy feel to it at the beginning there.
Like slow-mo, like everything. Uh-huh. Well, that's how they say it works in real life, right? When you're in those kind of moments, it's like everything just happens in slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's what's really like. I don't know. I've never been in a sword fight. Don't intend to.
I have a couple brothers, so I've been in a couple. Yeah, I just wish they would just... This is still not too bad, but... I think Adamson, I appreciate Adamson trying... Oh, Bulgy Bear.
Yeah, with his paws in his mouth.
That's
nice.
Great. I appreciate Andrew Adamson trying to shoot this in a way that was different. but I mean, I don't want to get on him too much. I appreciate that. I'm always pushing him to don't do the same old, try something different. But here I just kind of think, you know, just shooting it as a traditional sword fight would have been the way to go, I think. Whether, like, wrestling each other, and then later they're like, it looks like it's going to come to a fist fight in the slow motion. What makes it unique in the book is the way the spectators are a part of the action, sort of. Mm. Like, Lewis actually has, it's almost like Lewis is writing a script for an audio drama, the way he writes it so that the spectators are describing what they're seeing. Lewis, as a narrator, doesn't tell you. He has the spectators say,
yeah.
Oh, what happened? I missed it. And they describe it. And I think that would have been, it would have been better to have the, I guess, no, you know what? They have to have them far, far apart so they can have the dramatic battle charge. That's why they have to have them, the spectators, far away. That's so dumb. It would have been cool to have them be like really close and have it be like a football game where they're cheering on their team. And
I think they want it to be more personal and just like it's just the two of you, which it works. I think if we cared more about Peter, it would work better. I think we care enough where we're like, oh crap, this is not maybe going to end well for him, but we're not like as emotionally invested in him as a character just because he's kind of been a brat, right, a lot of it. Mm-hmm. So that probably would have made it a little bit different. And then mm-hmm. you wouldn't have needed the spectators to kind of like get you on his side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like they do a good job of, you know, you get a sense of real danger with the fight because of the injuries and, and when he, Ella, you know, your majesty's doing very well for his age. Oh, and you kind of groan. And then when he puts his arm back in here, he's dislocated. Feel it. This feels like a physical fight that's happening.
I love the interaction between Peter and Edmund in this bit. And for me, this bit in the movie where this is where it was like, oh, stab in the heart. Like, this now I'm invested.
Line from the last battle we just missed, right?
Yeah.
I have my sound off, but that's where he says, what happens back home if you...
Yeah.
What happens back home if you die here, which is Eustace in the last battle. Amanda, they're talking about Miraz's age, I think. He says, but your majesty's doing extremely well for his age.
Talking about,
and then they tighten that.
Yeah. Because they're like, yeah, you know, Peter, he's young, he's mm-hmm. more fit, and he's got years and years of experience, even though he's like a kid. They're mm-hmm. banking on, you know...
Yeah.
Peter doing the job.
Mm-hmm. I think we've talked a little bit about today about the scenes that we can't wait to see from the book or whatever, and obviously this is one of them. As soon as you hear they're making Prince Caspian into a movie, one of the first things you think of is the single combat. That's going to be a great scene, and I think it's really disappointing the way they did it. I think they tried way too hard, and just really playing it simple, I think would have been the way to go. I think they way overcomplicated it.
Yeah, I don't mind it the way it is. I have no large objections to the way it is now. I'm open to seeing other adaptions, other interpretations, but I think this, for me, it works.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also not quite as picky as you are.
I guess. I love the boxing match feel in the book of them shouting at each other and stuff, and there's just none of that here. And I find the slow motion really cheesy. Sergio is great, though.
Yes.
Have I said that yet? Have I said that Sergio is really good in this
movie?
You
may have mentioned it once or twice.
Yeah, I'm with you there, Reaper Jeep 775. I just look at the armor in the scene. That's really cool.
Yeah, the armor is very nice.
It is funny. See, the whole thing of Peter letting him up, I mean, even in the, I guess in the book, Miraz, he just trips and falls when he's down. And then that's when Peter decides not to kill him. But here, Peter straight up knocked him down, you know? He has every right to kill him. Like, that's the goal. I'm trying to kill Miraz. Like, the term said, the fight shall be to the death, the reward is total surrender. Like, what does Peter think they're trying to do here?
Yeah, I think...
I don't know if they quite conveyed that in the movie.
Yeah, I think because in the movie, I think Peter Actually, I don't know. Yeah, I don't really know. But yeah.
I think, I mean, like, it's almost like, aren't you essentially forfeiting if you don't kill him?
Or if, I think
and
what
and giving it to Caspian, that doesn't make any sense. Like, the deal was king versus king, wasn't it? Like, handing the sword to Caspian, it seems like that doesn't fulfill the terms of the duel.
Yeah, technicalities. I think what maybe he was hoping, or, you know, what their end thing was if we can get it, we'll fight to the death, but if we can get it to the, for them to just surrender, that is a more merciful, that's what we would prefer to do. And so that's what they're kind of trying, you know, like, he'll kill him if he really has to, but if he doesn't have to, he's not going to.
And I see what they're going for here, obviously, with, like, Caspian's going to spare Miraz's life here shortly, and the reaction shots of cutting to Glizelle and to Pespina, to them going, wow, I guess there's a different way to be a king. And, like, that the idea of the values of the old Narnia are coming back. I understand what they're going for, and they're partially successful. But it's just, it also makes you go, but wait a minute, I thought they agreed. What's the point of the duel if they're not going to kill each other? But
yeah.
And there's a theme of passing on swords throughout the movie. Like when Caspian takes Peter's sword when they first meet, when they're fighting. And then Peter actually voluntarily hands it to him here, say, you kill him. And then at the end of the movie, Peter will hand him the sword again. So there's kind of a passing on the mantle. It's kind of a recurring idea throughout the movie.
And then this is like, okay, well, plan B.
That's a neat moment when they cheer when he lets him live, though. I guess I'm mixed on the idea. I don't know. Very conveniently placed patch of grass there, wasn't it, for
that
sword?
Very, extremely.
It was fate. Here's a stump question for you guys in the comment section on the YouTube comments. So who kills Miraz in the book? I'm going to cheat. I'm pretty sure. Who actually stabs Miraz in the book? First person to comment wins nothing.
Except fame and accolades.
My respect. And I'm going to double check in the book just to make sure I'm right, because that would be really embarrassing.
I think I know. But I'll let
And Dot is saying Glizelle. Oh, but Amanda's saying Sepespian. Oh, but ReaperTube775 and Marcus are saying Glizelle. We have a dispute. I thought it was Glizelle. I always get them mixed up. I want to double check the book here. You talk about something, Jim Fan. I'll find it.
Great battle scene going on. I mean, but yes, I do like this battle scene. Except those are extremely round rocks. Like, did they, like, carve them to be that round? Or did they make them out of cement? I'm not sure. But, yeah. But now they're kind of bombing Aslan's How. And
it was, in fact... Hang on, let me...
Did you find it?
Here. Yes, it was, in fact, Glizelle. I can't see the camera here. Where is it? It is right. That's for your insults, Marie. It was but Glizelle stopped to stab his king. So it's actually, so the movie got it wrong. In the book, it's Glizelle that stabs.
Yeah, well, in my understanding, and I could be wrong, so someone can correct me on this, but my understanding was that in the movie, the characters of Glizelle and Sepespian their names are switched, and there was never an explanation or a reason. It's just that Glizelle got Sepespian stuff and Sepespian got Glizelle stuff, and that's just how it worked out.
Yep, I don't know why that. Gotta ask Marcus and McFeely about that one.
Maybe they were like, Glizelle sounds like a nicer name for the nicer guy, so we want this actor. He looks more like a Glizelle. Maybe that's what it was. I don't know.
but I haven't talked about Pier Francisco Favino playing Glizelle. I think he's probably another one of the best performances in the movie.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
He's got a great subtlety. He really conveys, with just a couple scenes, he really conveys a lot about that character being in doubt about, is this really the only way? Is this the way things have to be?
Yes. Plus, he has an awesome name.
That's true. He was actually, when I said that Sergio Castellano needed a translator, his translator was Pier Francesco Favino.
Well, there you go.
I don't especially like this battle. I think at this point, I've just lost my connection to the characters, and I'm just kind of waiting for them to all wake up. I'm waiting for the dust to clear, literally in this case, dust to clear, and then just see who's alive when it's over. I think there's some technical, very, admirable things in this scene, but I don't know. I'm just kind of over it at this point. I'm not really in the story anymore.
I think what it's got going for it is that it's very different from maybe what you would find in another movie, where it doesn't really follow some of the same... I'm blanking, but it looks different, and it kind of runs a little bit differently than maybe your standard two battles meet on a field and fight. You know, like
how is it different from that?
Well, there's just different aspects to it, like how they come from underground, and then the trees are involved. Just to me, it's slightly different, makes it a little bit more not standard. Yeah,
it just seems like another battle to me, I guess.
but you're
I wish there was more. Again, the battle is so brief in the book, because in the book it's more about, again, what's really happened to Narnia is something spiritually has happened to Narnia. Something about Narnia's soul is dead, and that's what the climax of the book is about them going through Narnia and freeing everybody and healing everybody and turning kids into pigs and stuff like that. But here it's a pure military victory. We won because we beat you with our swords. And in the book, they win over the hearts of the Telmarine people. There is a battle, but it's really brief. And that's not what we really remember about the Prince Caspian, the climax, I mean. So I guess this kind of takes something that I thought was much more interesting and impactful and emotional in the book and cheapens it to just swinging swords at each other.
Well, you know, it's a contractual agreement that there has to be a battle.
Yep. I mean, yeah, if you're making a spiritual sequel to Lord of the Rings, there's got to be a battle. Sorry, I know people tell me, stop hating on the... People tell me I say too much about, Hollywood is bad. I'll trying to lay off of that a little bit. I said plenty of good things about the movie. The first half, I have mostly positive things to say. And I overall like it, but there's some things I really don't like.
I love how the
smoke is very cool throughout the scene.
They try the whole eagle thing again, and it just doesn't work out.
Doesn't work at all.
At all. And they're like, well, there goes that idea.
Yeah, I'm with you, Dot. I'm not sure about Reepy Cheep wearing armor. It feels wrong to me.
But then again, I mean, he's an oversized mouse. Not a rat, a mouse.
But like, I feel like his strength is that his stealthiness and nimbleness would be his strength. I don't know. I always feel the same way about bat. Oh yeah, the brace yourself line.
Brace
yourself.
Oh, okay. That just no. And then they're like, "Well, let's just retreat." And then, nope, can't. And then.
And we'll have another charge, and we'll bring the music back.
This bit was. Yeah, but I could do without this. This doesn't really do anything for me.
Oh no, Susan.
And Caspian's like, oh no, I must rescue her. Oh wait, she'll be fine. It's just right there. It's not that far to go.
It's true. That was a much to do about nothing. Crush them. Bringing back the, I don't know, there's a lot of reused music here, and I wish that, and most of it sounds almost identical. I wish that Harry Gregson-Williams had evolved the music. A lot of it is virtually copy-pasted from the other movie.
Yeah,
I don't object
I didn't
to them having
like
more
that.
The same themes, of course. I just think I wish he had developed it more.
Yeah, that was one thing that was disappointing for me about Prince Caspian, was about how much the music was just almost the same. Like, I'm all about continuing themes, but it just felt exactly the same. And one of the things that I did appreciate about Don Treader was that the music, it developed its own themes. And it did keep some of the old ones, but it developed its own themes. It stood out. It stood alone from a music sense. And I loved that.
And sorry, Marcus, let me show the time code again here. The time code actually might be a few seconds off, I noticed when I tested it today. By the end of the movie, it might be like, you know, 5 seconds off or so. But as long as you're approximately there.
For me, actually, I'm comparing mine to the screen, and it's like almost spot on.
Yeah, I think mine is too. So never mind. Maybe I'm wrong. Aslan looks awesome for now. The visual effects look great, great, great. The interaction feels so believable. And then when it cuts to the close-up of Aslan, it doesn't look good at all. When it cuts to his close-up in just a moment, that looks phony to me. Not as bad as the dream one. See ya, Christian. Thanks for listening. And he says, things never happen the same way twice. Twice.
Like, wait, is it, what? Say that again?
There is a balance here of they're just chit-chatting, having a picnic, talking, and there's a battle going on, guys. Hello.
Hurry on now.
Aslan looks at his watch. Oh, is it that time already? And we can never know what would have happened, Lucy. That's not what... Oh, by the way, we didn't talk about the horribly botched line from before. Aslan says in the movie, every year you grow, so shall I. Which is not... The book is, every year you grow, you will find me bigger. So that's talking about Lucy's perception of Aslan is changing. It's how that Aslan is actually changing. In the movie's line, every year you grow, so shall I, that implies that Aslan steps on a scale and sees he's a few pounds heavier and says, oh, I guess Lucy must be growing. Like there's some bizarre connection between them that actually makes Aslan grow. Anyway, that's a clear... I think they just changed the wording slightly because they thought it sounded better. And it's... What a great example of bad adaptation where you can make changes, but you have to understand
the concept behind it.
You have to understand the point behind it to make sure that the meaning remains the same, even if you're changing certain things. We got a from Miss Pevensey saying Harry Gregson Williams should come back for the silver chair. I think I'm up. Look, I think he did a fine job on the first two movies, but. I at this point, I really just want to see something totally new and fresh and see all new people come and put their take on it. Now, there's other talented composers out there, and I would love to see them put their take on Narnia.
I like the pause here where it's like, makes you feel like...
And the tree gets him.
And then the tree gets him. It's like, well, there goes that moment.
Yep.
But it establishes that Glozell, in and of himself, he is... a conflicted character. He's not, as we say about Miraz, an inherently bad dude. Mm-hmm. He has a conscience.
Yeah.
As opposed to this guy who kind of doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. This level in the video game is really short and easy. Yeah. You just smash the Telmarines and they really can't do anything to hurt you, as I recall.
I never played the video game, so I wouldn't know.
What? You call yourself a Narnia Webber and you haven't played the video game?
I don't play video games, so no.
Okay. I guess I like the idea of the trees. Just in the book, it's more the trees just scare them away. They're so utterly freaked out by the sight of the trees that they just run for it. And I love that idea more than it actually being a tearing them up and stuff.
I was watching Once Upon a Time. I was getting caught up on this latest season, and they do the whole tree root being a weapon thing is very very present in this latest season. I'm like, I wonder where they got that from.
Reaper Jeep 775 for Aslan, pointing out, yes, before Peter said for Narnia, now he says for Aslan.
Yes, and that's very subtle but very key shift.
I was at Moonlight Centaur, for the record. I was just joking about, I don't think the video, I have played it, but I admit it, but I don't think the video game, oh, you have to play it. It's it's something that, oh, you have to be a Narnia, if you're not if you don't play the video game, you're not a Narnia Webber or something. It's not a good game.
In that case, I don't know what I'm doing here. I love how it's just Lucy and they're like, wait a second. There's just one girl there. We can take her. Oh, there's someone else there.
Oh, but he's just a CGI lion. Never mind. We'll go right through him. Hello, JM in Colombia. What's up? Thanks for making it for the end, at least. Thanks, everybody, by the way. Yeah, I don't know why Aslan... Aslan looks the best in wardrobe, and I think he looks... I guess he looks better than this in Don Treader, but not as good as he does in wardrobe. I don't know why that is. And most of Prince Caspian doesn't look good at all.
He's not in Prince Caspian as much.
Yeah, I guess that's why.
Either, so... Yeah, I don't know.
Now, the River God, if you haven't read the book, it's like, what? Why is the river coming to life? Because they never really set it up. I feel like they could easily have done that. Have Trumpkin say something like, oh, the trees are asleep and the River God, haven't seen him in a while, or something like that. And in the book, it's a dam. It's not just a bridge. So this has greater significance, breaking the bridge apart.
Yeah.
Loose my chains.
It's a nice bridge. I mean, you did good work on it.
This is one of the big set pieces, and Amanda says the River God looks like Andrew Adamson. So take a look at that. This is one of the big set pieces in the Logos Theaters in Caspian. They did. Reepicheep 775. They switched visual effects houses for this. In fact, I think all three movies had completely different visual effects houses.
Fun.
Remember how many set pictures we had from this location?
It was a lot.
We had, I think, hundreds. There were some we never even actually posted. There must have been someone on the crew who was just going ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. That's all I can think. We had so many set photos.
And people, and it was just like, because the water effect was practical where they were spraying the water, but obviously there was no... water god there, so everyone's like, why is there just like spraying water into the air? What's going on?
Let's see if I can find some of those photos on Narnia Web.
I'm sure a lot of them
we had videos too, didn't we? We had videos.
We had all sorts of stuff.
I forgot about that. Rise, kings and queens of Narnia. The kneeling moment, I think, works fairly well. How do you feel about the Reepicheep tail scene coming up? Let me quickly show
you. I'm trying to remember. I might need to watch it again and see.
Quick headline here from July 2007 when they were filming this. We were getting...
Oh, yeah.
This is just a few of them, though. We had so many that... A lot of them, like the photographer was standing on the bridge. Can't wait till it starts happening for Prince Caspian. Anyway, Reepicheep getting his tail back. How do you feel about that? The way it comes off. Hello?
Oh, what do I think? I'm watching it. I'm thinking.
I think I guess the debate is, does it come across as a little too comical? Like when they first show up and they're playing the flute music or whatever. Some people think that, oh, they're just being overdramatic and you're supposed to laugh.
I didn't laugh.
In the book, this is a really sad, genuinely sad moment.
Yeah.
When he's lost his tail.
I didn't.
All that remained of poor Reepicheep.
Yeah. Looking back at it again, I'm like, I don't have any strong object. I don't object to anything that I'm seeing here.
I think it is definitely a little more, maybe a lot more comical coming across than it is. I think we're supposed to chuckle a little bit during this, whereas I think it's a big tragedy in the book when... Oh, he lost his tail, and it's really moving when the Peepikeek and the others are going to cut off their tails. And here I just, especially when he starts saying, well, it's not just the honor, it's also for balance and climbing and things like that. And there's this reaction shot of Lucy and Aslan, where they're looking at each other like, isn't he cute? Oh, he's so silly.
I do remember all the times I went to see it. Yeah, when it got to the part
where...
Here
it is, right here. Lucy and Aslan kind of looking at each other like, wow, he's a great character, isn't he?
Yeah, but like people laughed. Yeah, I guess the audience did laugh when like they came in carrying him on the stretcher. And I was like, that's not funny.
Mm-hmm.
He's dying.
I'm glad they have it in the movie, for sure. But I just think that's a part where I would tend to agree with the criticism of them making Reepicheep more comical than he is in the book. My huge humility. I like that line. JM asking about news about the Silver Chair. Last we heard, they're supposed to start filming later this year, but we will see if that pans out.
I am very much in that.
Go to narniweb.com.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Mm-hmm. I think it'll. I'm about 55% that they're going to start filming later this year. If they don't, I'll start to get a little impatient. I know there's a lot of people that are already impatient about, are they never going to make this movie? I think so far the delays have made sense. If they don't start rolling the cameras this year, then I'll start to say, okay, when is this movie going to happen?
Yeah.
This scene here, we have set photos of them with Bacchus and Silenus actually in this scene.
And then
they
were
just
like,
cut them out, I guess.
Cut.
Please give us, please give us the courtesy of an Easter egg.
I think out of context, it would have just been extremely confusing to your average moviegoer. So I understand why they cut it.
Well, you just have to set them up, set up who they are. I guess the book doesn't really set them up.
And in the movie, it's like that wasn't what they were going for. It would have felt
like they were going for the straight up military victory in the movie. They weren't going for the heart of old Narnia is returned. They were just going for, nope, we beat them with their swords. Marcus, Silver Chair, I think it's got to get made eventually. Eventually the rights will go into the public domain. And come on, once they're in public domain, come on, someone's going to make them. So it's a matter of when. It's not a matter of if Silver Chair gets made. It's a matter of will it happen in the next few years or in the next 20, 30 years is the question.
I do love the costumes in the scene, with the exception of Caspian's little skirt.
I think he accidentally put on Susan's costume.
But Susan's costume is beautiful, so all is forgiven. Mm-hmm.
Well, we might be doing, JM wants a Narniweb shirt, might be doing new ones maybe later this year. Probably, if Silver Chair is coming out next year, we might have some in anticipation of that. Here we are, the penultimate scene. Yeah, I don't like Caspian's costume.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some cultural, historical relevancy in that, but just you should take a screenshot of that.
I'm sure that's what they told Ben at least.
Right?
Oh, it's very historically accurate. He's like, oh, okay.
Did you do you remember, it was a while ago on Twitter, a couple of the actors were going back and forth about some of their was it worst cost, or they're basically just kind of dragging each other about costumes.
William hated his haircut.
Or haircuts or something.
One.
And I've been like, this would have been a great addition to that conversation. Just being like, well, William, at least you didn't have to wear this.
Right. Exactly. The Silver Chair will probably just all wear all green, and they'll just put it in later in post.
Right.
Bah humbug. Sorry, guys.
Dude, I read that in the new Avengers movie, Spider-Man's costume. Was it completely CGI?
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay,
so
I wouldn't know. I heard the costume.
I know in Civil War, it was all just motion capture.
And I'm like, wow, nothing is practical anymore.
It's impractical to be practical.
It's more expensive
than
that.
This is cool with the tree. That's a neat visual of it.
I think that's really awesome. I thought that was a great concept.
And it's almost like question. I think in the movie, you get the sense that was always there, just like the wardrobe, and that Aslan just opened the door. Whereas in the book, Aslan just creates a new opening for this specific purpose. Here, I think you'd almost get the sense that it was always there. And that's a cool reveal, the way the camera kind of pans around there.
Yeah. I didn't necessarily see it that way. I mean, created versus opened it, I think the end result is the same, because either way, even if it was there the whole time, it wasn't doing anything.
Sure.
And no one was going to be able to do anything with it without Aslan. So, to me, it's it's still all about him. He made it happen.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool that it's on the edge of a cliff, too.
Yeah.
So it's really a literal leap of faith. Oh, boy. Oh, man.
Well, hand over the sword,
It's coming.
Got to do that.
I'm just going to ignore this part and read. Read the book.
Think happy thoughts. Think
deep breaths.
Happy.
Deep breaths.
Like I said before, I don't hate this on a spiritual level or whatever. It kind of is there. Costumes are nice.
Yeah, aren't the costumes pretty?
I think you get almost as much enjoyment out of hating this as you do displeasure, just because it's fun to hate it.
I probably passed into that realm where I can actually just enjoy hating it to some extent. Maybe. I don't know.
It is what it is.
It's like Susan should be Queen Susan the Gentle out of the ancient past. She shouldn't be this cute girl that I'm hooking up with. That's what it... If they had done a better job establishing the Queen Susan the Gentle persona and that whole thing and how much Caspian revered them, maybe, and then could it develop how that could translate into romance, maybe I wouldn't absolutely hate this. But, I mean, as a movie, it's like they haven't developed this enough and it's cheesy. As an adaptation, it just steps on the best part of the book, basically. That's all I've said. I feel dirty watching the...
Turn around. Whatever.
This is so dumb, because it's not that it's cheesy, that's part of it. It's that it's just stepping on the heart of the book. You know what?
Are you okay now?
I feel better. Okay.
Do you need to describe that for our audio audience?
Watch the video. Woo! I had to wash out this memory. Okay. I'm cleansed now. We can go on with the rest of the movie, because the last scene is actually kind of nice.
Someone says, my edited version does not have this scene, Rebecca says.
Well, ooh, send it to us.
That sounds like that might be the definitive version then.
It would get popular. Woo. Okay. I think I screamed during the commentary 9.5 years ago. So at least I spared our audio audience. I just took a shower.
The music, though. The music in this bar is great. I love the song.
Yeah, I guess so. It's cheesy. In context, I like it. Whenever I hear it out of context, I kind of groan. But in context, I like it. Oh, great transition here.
Yes.
You have to... You have CGI to look really
hair,
to see the cracks.
But the rest of it worked. I have to say, watching this back, this movie, it holds up well in terms of its age. Like, this was made 10 years ago, but I don't watch and I'm like, wow, that looks really dated. When I watch Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there are some aspects of that that seem very dated to me.
Uh-huh.
This one, not as much, but I'm sure if I examined it a little bit closer. I mean, obviously some of the CGI and stuff, but...
Yeah. I would tend to agree. So yeah, certainly visually it holds up very well. And they got the torch thing in there.
Of course.
I don't know if the execution quite came off. I know the intention was to make it a last parting bit of comedy to lighten things up, because it's been so serious the past couple scenes. I don't know if it quite works or not. But I'm glad they got the last line from the book in there. And here we are with our credits.
And
so,
done.
10 years later, how has your opinion, and everyone in the comments too, how has your opinion of the movie changed over time compared to the first time you saw it? How about you, Jim Fan?
I still love it. It's just a fun movie, and it works cinematically and visually. I love it, and I think it hits the right emotional moments for me. So overall, yeah, I still love it.
I definitely don't like it as much as, like, the first time I saw it, I think it was a big thumbs up. And now I see it as a more mixed. There's things I really like about it, there's things I don't like. And that goes for it as a movie and as an adaptation. There's a few aspects of Narnia, what I love about the book, that they just nailed so well on an emotional level. And then there's just some things that are just so fly in the face of that. So I'm just mixed on this, I guess. I give it I don't know if you like star rating systems. I give it 3.5 out of 5, I guess. It's kind of a reluctant 3.5. Like, it's above average. I feel like if I had not read the book, I would have watched this once and gone, oh, that was a little too long, but it was okay, I guess, and would not have felt compelled to see it again.
I think for me, it's just a lot of different aspects that go into it, and it's not just, like, the movie itself I love, but also the whole process behind the movie, like, following the movie being made and everything. that was just a very enjoyable experience to me. And then it just kind of culminated with a great movie. Whereas with Dawn Treader, that was an enjoyable experience, but then it did not pay off at
all.
You
like you stop pretending you didn't like Dawn Treader, at least when you first.
I was talking
to you the day after. We had a huge argument over Skype about it. I remember I was there.
There's still parts of it that I do like. It's just as time has gone on, and a lot of the reason why I don't like Dawn Treader as much now as I did initially is because of all the negativity that came after that. Like, because there was so much backlash and people weren't enjoying it, and then you look at it differently and suddenly it's just not as enjoyable anymore. And I think that's part of the reason. If I had been locked, if I didn't have the internet and I just watched the movie and that was it, there would still be parts that I hate, but I probably wouldn't have come away, weeks and months down the line and been like, oh yeah, I really didn't like that.
I think Ruby Cheap 775 nails it here in the comments. She says, yeah, I have major problems with it, but I can't hate it. And that is kind of my review of it. I almost wonder when I start the movie, well, why don't I hate this movie? And then usually about halfway into the movie, I go, oh yeah, that's that. Or I'll say, I'll be watching it going, why don't I love this movie? That's what I meant. And then halfway through, it's, oh, that's why. It just doesn't deliver at the end. I think the bottom doesn't. They do a pretty good job of establishing the sadness of old Narnia being gone, and then they don't really convey the joy when it does return. The payoff just isn't there for me.
So that's me and Dawn Treader, where like I get through the first 20 minutes, I'm like, man, I really like this, and then it just kind of all falls apart.
Right.
And then the end, it's like you get to the end, and you're like, oh yeah, like this part's really great, but then the middle is just so not great.
Yeah, we can totally agree on the experience of anticipating it with other fans.
Yes, that's can't compare.
Following the news, speculating about why is Peter fighting Caspian and all that stuff, and the debates and everything. And now that I think I'm really excited for Silver Chair, and that now we'll have the podcast every 2 weeks, kind of rather than being sporadic, have them all the time, so that we can really have the play by play. Someone asked if I'll do videos. I don't know. I think I might just be focused on the podcast.
Mm.
But either way, that'll be. I'm looking forward to, like, honestly, yeah, that's really the main thing I'm looking forward to with the Silver Chair is getting the band back together and anticipating another movie.
Yeah.
I have kind of mixed feelings on how the Silver Chair, how I think it'll turn out at this point. But
it's the journey itself tends to be quite enjoyable.
The journey is the destination.
Yes. sometimes there's really rough spots on that journey where you're like, is this angst really worth it? And then sometimes
I mean, that's not totally true. I mean, like, the book is so special to me, and obviously I'd rather have it not be made at all than have it be made poorly. But either way, it'll be fun to do the play-by-play along the way and react to the news and stuff. If the current plan pans out and they start filming this later this year, that could mean we could start getting casting announcements late this summer.
Yeah. I did hope we'd be getting stuff already, and we haven't, which makes me sad because I was one of those people where I saw that roomie about Millie Bobby Brown, and I was like, I want that to happen. And now I'm like, it's not going to happen. But, like,
probably not.
That made me excited.
I don't know if I want it. I mean, I think she's a little too old. I'd like to have a younger
Jill. She would be by now. Like, but if, stuff had kind of started, I don't know. But I was like, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Amanda. Amanda's saying experience of anticipating the movie is fun. And so, hope you'll be there. Strider of the White Tree saying my biggest problem with the movie is that they ruin many of the characters. I can see that. Certainly, if you're a big fan of Peter, I can imagine this would not be your favorite.
But Lucy?
Movie. But they did a nice job on Lucy. pretty good, a good job on Reaper Cheap.
In Dawn Treader, they didn't
the
ruin
the Bulgy Bear. Oh, they nailed him.
Yeah, that's true. But like, but you can get the characters. But Great Mist, you guys. Come on.
Yeah. I'd forgotten about the different version of This Is Home from Switchfoot they have in here. They have a horrible, horrible version of it in the credits.
Oh, yeah. The other one's much better.
No, this one, it's like, it's not just the instrumental. Like, a lot of the lyrics are different.
Yeah.
And it's painful.
I don't know why. I never really understood why it was different. But I was like, whatever.
I'm, I'm not a part of these.
Reba Cheap says, I want an animated version of Narnia. Personally, I think a really great animated version, that would be very cool to
see.
Something
in the style of Song of the Sea or Secret of Kells, I think, is what I like to see.
Because it would be, like, think... One of the things I loved about Dawn Treader is that the end, remember the end credits where they had, it was Pauline Bain's illustrations kind of come to life. Just think Narnia animated in that style.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that would
Becca's
be...
asking about Narnia and zombies, if we'll jinx it. Because hey. Rillian called the Caspian Susan romance. It's an April Fool's joke and it came true. So will Narnia and zombies come true? If it does, I want a cut of the I want a cut of the box office. That's what I'm saying.
For the record, I have seen Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. It's not a horrible movie, but it is like satire. So,
you know, there's a producer watching. You know that Joe Johnston's watching right now going, oh, Jim fans saying that they should have zombies in Narnia. I guess we should do that.
You know, it would be an interesting interpretation, but not like as the normal one. But yeah, I don't know.
Interesting interpretation.
With our luck, they're going to remake these movies like 3 times in our lifetime anyway. So...
Marcus is saying Truffle Hunter was perfect. I wish they had developed Truffle Hunter's faith more, and the we're beasts, we don't change, and they don't really quite establish how Truffle Hunter, how many reasons Truffle Hunter has to doubt that the Pevensies are coming or that Aslan's coming, but still holds on. So that storyline is not really in, it's not really a part of the, I guess I see, if I guess I always think of Truffle Hunter as kind of a, this really old guy, this really old, wise, ancient stories, and he has a lot more energy in the movie, but CGI looks really good. And Truffle Hunter was great in The Hobbit.
I mean, basically everyone was in The Hobbit, so... Doesn't it, like, it's like British actors, you have to count more the ones who weren't in Harry Potter as opposed to the ones who have been in Harry Potter. Yeah.
Yep.
Well,
I think we're here. Amanda, yeah, this will get reposted. I guess we'll just leave it on YouTube, but either way, I'll repost just the audio as the next podcast episode. And then we've just got a couple more podcast episodes that we're going to take a break for the summer. That'll be it for this season. And then we'll ask for more feedback from you guys on what we can change and do better. And then we'll be back. Hopefully, we'll be doing a Silver Chair movie by the time we come back. But either way, we'll have content we'll get into.
Oh, yeah.
There's that really great thread in the Talking Beast Facebook group about what, if you had wanted an eighth Narnia book, what would you have done? I really want to do a conversation about that. And then since people have said, you guys are often too hard on the movie, being really in at least, are often too hard on the movie, we may do an episode that's just, here's like 10 things that we really think the movie's nailed and got right.
But you could only talk about those, okay?
Exactly. Well, yeah, I'll try. Because look, we're in Silver Chair mode. We're talking about the future. It makes sense to kind of be leaning towards the things that they could do better. So it makes sense why we tend to lean towards the kind of the more negative stuff. But it's in fairness, yes, it's been disproportionate how the number of negativity we have towards the Walden movie. So we should do an episode just talking about, here's the stuff they really got right, and just talk about Georgie Henley the whole time.
And I'll MC it.
No, there's more than
so
that.
So just, I'll MC it.
Okay, good. Okay, well, I think we're about ready to wrap up. Becca, sorry, we're just, Becca saying, wait, I love the podcast, just going away for a couple months so we can regroup and plan the next series. And Ruth is saying, could we have more news? So you have to do the podcast. Probably if during our break, if Jill Pohl gets cast, I guess we'll have to do something.
Oh, of course.
But the current plan is to take a break, look at feedback, regroup, make plans for the next stage, and go from there.
Because it might come as a shocker to some of you guys, but most of us have lives.
So Jim Fan has a life, apparently.
It's news to me, but...
I just do Narnia web, personally. good. Okay, well, thanks, everybody, for listening and watching. Thanks, Reaper Jeep 775, Straight Over the White Tree, Amanda, Rose, Marcus, Rebecca, Izzy, Becca, Amy, AJ Aiken... Kevin McQuaid. Am I missing anybody? Sorry if I missed anybody. I'm just scrolling up here. JM dropped in for a while. Dot was here. Ick, I-C-K-N-G was here for a little bit. Thanks so much. This is it's such a cool thing the internet has, where like Narnia doesn't have the massive fan base of, at least not as vocal of a fan base as something like Harry Potter or Star Wars. And of course, it's not as much in the news, it's not as current of a thing, but it's because of the internet, we can take the few of us that are still, you know, paying attention to this, even though the movies aren't necessarily in the works right now, and we can all come together and... Sorry, I'm tearing up. Thanks, guys. And maybe we'll do a... Maybe in Dawn Treader, we'll have... you and I can just do a wrestling match or something.
Yeah.
And debate that one. And then maybe we'll do the 20th anniversary in another 10 years.